call this meeting of government operations to order. And Representative Freiberg, I was given something that I was told was for you, but I'm going to confiscate it here. I tried using it, but it doesn't make any noise. Oh,
okay. Maybe that's why it was given to us.
It's from Representative Teese. It's from Representative Teese, but I'm going to confiscate it. Anyway, members, Representative Lean, do you want to move the minutes from the April 10th meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lean moves the approval of the minutes as published or as printed from April 10th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The motion's approved. And members, in your packet, I'm going to call your attention to this right away. The last week when we had the meeting with the pensions, the three executive directors from the three main pensions had some issues with some testimony, and they just asked to have this letter given to the members and be included in the record for the minutes of the meeting. They didn't want to come back and testify it and get into an argument, but they felt strongly. So we're just, there's a letter here, read it at your leisure. They had some issue with some of the statements that were made. And with that, we'll move on to the first bill on the agenda, which is Representative Fisher here. Oh, there he is, hiding behind the... Representative Fisher, I'll move House File 1769. We recommend it to pass and move to rules. And I understand that there's an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is.
And is this...
The A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment. And Representative Fisher, do you want to explain what the amendment does?
Yes, sir, I can. It does a couple of different things. First of all, is it clarifies in terms of the composite of the Legislative Water Commission. It clarifies that minority representation will be two people from the largest majority party caucus at that point in time. Another section that it does is it addresses an area that refers to the PCA lines 2.5, 2.6, say the commission shall oversee the activities of the Pollution Control Agency. Those two lines are being deleted. And then it's creating another subsection 5 expiration, where it would sunset this, would say this section expires July 1st, 2018.
So the members understand the amendment and what it does? If so, I'll move that the 1769 A2 amendment be adopted. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion's approved and the amendment's adopted. And so, Representative Fisher, please describe your bill.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today with this bill. What this bill does is it reestablishes a legislative commission on water. Years ago, the legislature had a bipartisan bicameral commission that was established to oversee water issues in the state. There was a lot of work that was going on at the time in terms of establishing policy, and so much of the work had to be done off session, and because they were not finding enough time during committee to be able to do the work. On top of that, there was a lot of information that needed to be brought together, and it was very difficult for members on their own to be able to do the work, or even just a couple of people during the off-session times. And so this commission was originally brought together to do a lot of the work to lay the groundwork for our water laws that we have today. Back in the late 1990s, this commission was disbanded, and I'm bringing it back. And the reason that I'm asking to have it brought back is for several reasons. Is I've been working very hard on water issues, particularly around the lake of White Bear Lake in northern Ramsey County, where we've seen dramatic losses of what's been happening because of what appears to be pumping from groundwater. The lake has, in the last 10 years, lost 25% of its volume, and at the rate we're going, it appears that we'll probably, with the next few years, be losing another 25% of its volume. When we were trying to address the issue, one of the things that we were finding out is that a number of the water laws that are out there that might be applicable to help address the situation are vague. Some of them are not well-defined. Even some of the tools that may be available to the DNR, the DNR is recognizing that they may not have the opportunities or the proper tools to deal with the issue. Where it really came to my attention is that one of the areas that people realize that would make a difference is if we had water conservation and water conservation pricing in what they would call water management areas. Water management areas are set up in areas where water sustainability is not occurring and is having a great impact on our natural resources or on neighboring wells. And some things we found out is that, as I was talking to members in the Environmental Natural Resource Policy Committee, we were trying to have this provision go on for requiring water conservation pricing. As we went through three committee meetings on just this one small thing that would just apply to water management areas, it was very difficult to find, you know, all the information that we needed so that we could apply it in such a way that it could be used in water management areas that were having great impact, that where great impact was occurring, but not be used with unintended consequences elsewhere. And as we went through the process, we found out that after three committee hearings that we ended up I had to pull that part out of my bill because we just could not provide the information and could not figure out in that short of time how to rewrite this legislation. And this was something that to me had seemed real simple. Since then, a number of other things have come to my attention, some things we've kind of addressed, some things we haven't, is that in the water, the way water is being controlled right now is if somebody wants to drill a well, they go to the Department of Health, and the Department of Health gives them a permit, and they go out, and if you're drawing a building a well for a business or a large municipality, you might be spending $100,000 or more to put that well in. After that well is in, then you go to the DNR and ask them permission for how much water to pump out of it. It seems very disconnected because at that point in time, DNR is all of a sudden feels an obligation that they need to be allowing that water to be used and issue a permit for water to be pumped out of that aquifer, but at the same time, it's an aquifer that may already be under stress and going down. And it's, you know, that's one of the things that we found out in this process. It's kind of backwards. There are other problems when we get to permitting. There's some areas right now where we're finding that you could have a large portion of the people who are drawing out of the aquifer and there are no permittings going on. There's no control. There isn't even really a good idea of how much they're actually pumping. And if you've got a resource that's under great stress, there's not much they can do. And we're finding out that these issues are so complex, it takes a long time to try to deal with them. We've also come to our attention that in some parts of the state, particularly the southwest corner, that because of the water situations we have, that businesses are actually being turned down for their applications, and they're going to other states or other areas to relocate their business. And because of all the complications that are in there, I think this is something that's going to take a lot of work on. A perfect example is if water management areas are established, right now, the DNR doesn't have a lot of the tools in place that they're going to need to make sure that these areas function properly. They're going to be coming back to us with a study from their point of view of what they think they need to be done. But the problem is it's going to be a lot of work with a lot of things that could have unintended consequences that it's going to take longer than what we would have in committee time to be able to address it. Because it's such a complex issue, and having talked to a lot of people in the Senate, from having talked to people here in the House, talking to many different stakeholders, this was referenced to me at one time when we had issues that were similar in scope on water, that this kind of legislative water commission worked very well in helping manage that issue so we could have the proper time to do the work and come out with some great legislation that not only had bipartisan support but bicameral support, and we were able to move through very effectively and have and form some of the basics of some of the water law that we have out there today. And that's where we're coming from, where I'm coming from with this point of view right now for asking to have the Legislative Water Commission reestablished. And at that, I'd like to try to answer any questions or concerns.
Quick questions I have. Representative Pepin on the list. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Fisher. This seems to give this commission quite a bit of power. Just a couple of questions, if you don't mind. I maybe
Representative Pepin.
Questions. First, on the staff, on line 119, the Legislative Water Commission may appoint and fix the compensation of personnel and consultants necessary to enable the commission to carry out its duty. Is there what's the fiscal cost to this? And I guess I just don't have any. There's no information here about what this is going to cost. I'm just kind of curious how this works with the deadline and the cost and all this kind of thing.
And Representative Pepin, we're not a fiscal committee, but Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. I don't have the official note right now. I've talked to Greg Hubinger from the Legislative Commission. He's indicating right now that we'd be looking at something that's probably going to be about $170,000 a year to operate.
Representative Pepin.
And this would be then heard, I'm sorry, and this would then be heard at, be something that if this was approved and went forward, it would eventually go to Ways and Means where the fiscal note would be officially attached at that point.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fisher, I noticed the introduction of this bill was quite late, and maybe you could you clarify why you, the late, if this is so important, why we're meeting well past deadline?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. I appreciate the question. This is one of the things that, being a freshman, I was still learning the process I was going through, and I didn't think that we would need something like this as I first started dealing with the issues. I originally thought water is relatively easy, it shouldn't be a big deal. And one of the things that I learned that in some parts of the state, we have a surplus of water, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with it in ways that are about 180 degrees from the way we would handle water in southwest Minnesota or even here in the metropolitan area. And because of that and competing interests between agriculture and mining, how they look and use water versus how we would use water, reuse of water, that it becomes a very complicated issue. And in just the little work I was trying to do to get answers back and forth, I did not have enough time in my day trying to be able to bring information together. I'm looking at, even during session, you know, once session is over, spending a significant amount of my time trying to pull some of the resources together and some people to try to get work done. I'm finding that this is something much, much larger and bigger than one person can do. And even trying to work informally with a couple of people, the couple of people I've been working with, we're finding that it is a very huge thing. And particularly when we're trying to gather information together, I've been finding through my experience sometimes if it's one or two individuals trying to do things, it's sometimes very hard to get information in a very timely manner. When you've got a more official auspice working for you, it's much easier to have the information come and have some professional assistance in pulling that information together to make sure that we're not missing things in the process. And that's been my fears as I've been going through this, is not being able to catch the unintended consequences. And I can fear that trying to do some of these things in a shorter that might look like a good short-term fix may end up having unintended consequences. And going into a formal structure like this would reduce that possibility, because then we would have some very good, robust discussions that we could spend a couple of hours on going back and forth on the issues and things that we need to do. But we just don't have that kind of time in these kind of committee settings to be able to do that. And I didn't realize that until I got very late in the process here and realized how complex these issues were.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, what size of staff are, you said $170,000, what size of staff are you thinking that's going to pay for?
My understanding would be one
Fisher.
Full, thank you, Chair. Representative Pepin, my understanding it would be one full-time person and then a part-time support person that would be staffing this.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fisher, on line 2.5, it says the commissioner shall oversee the activities of the Pollution Control Agency. That seems pretty heavy-handed. I'm not sure, I don't know if oversee has been defined anywhere. So
Representative
it kind of indicates that looks that there'll be.
Representative Pepin, just so for your knowledge, the A2 amendment deletes line 2.5 and 2.6. FYI.
Oh, okay. Then I guess my question would be what exactly will be reviewed? So there's no oversight. That's good. The on line 2.1, what is shall review? What's your intention for shall review?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin. The review of the reports and recommendations is because if we're looking at trying to come up with good policy on how we move forward with our water situation that we have in our state to make sure that we're doing it in a sustainable way and also in a renewable way, that there are a lot of groups that provide a lot of information on this. And I've been flooded with a lot of it over the last couple of weeks. I have people providing me with extra reports. And it seems that the different reports are covering different areas, whether it's from an agricultural point of view, from a mining point of view. And what it's doing is just making sure that as these reports are coming out, that we're having a chance to take a look at them to see if there's things that we should be keeping in mind as we're doing policy to make sure that we're not missing anything and can prevent as many unintended consequences as possible.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I guess my question would be, I'm always very interested in how agencies work together, how they overlap, and I'm always interested in streamlining government, and which is why I'm very alarmed that in the state government finance bill we're apparently going to repeal the Sunset Commission that would do just that. So what I'm trying to figure out is, instead of having a water commission that will review the water policy reports of all these different groups, why not consolidate the Environmental Quality Board, the Board of Water Soil Resources, the Pollution Control Agency, and Department of Natural Resources reports somehow into one, as opposed to having, I don't know why we're apparently paying for all these different groups to do policy reports. It seems like that there's just an awful lot of, we've got one, two, three, four, five, four different groups that do water policy reports, and now we're going to add another layer, and we're going to have an additional water policy report. I don't know why we would spend another $170,000 to hire a staff person to do another water policy report when there's already apparently several organizations that do it. So I'm wondering how this is going to provide more efficiency and accountability in government.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. I think where we see more efficiency is each of these boards that we see here cover different areas of water. Example, on Pollution Control Agency, so much of the information that and work that they do is more is what's happening in terms of water quality, contamination issues, chemicals that may be creeping in there, which is much different than the Department of Natural Resources, which is where they're about allocating the resources, how much is being used, and whether it's having an impact on the wetlands or ferns and that type of area. So as you can see, they cover two different very areas of water, and the problem is when we're trying to do policy, the way one agency is treating water is much different than the issues that another agency is treating water, and this is where it gets to be a very complex issue very quickly because there are so many moving components that belong in different areas. You know, I really don't see how the Department of Natural Resources could really be very effective in managing areas of contamination that are impacting our water supplies, etc. And that's why it's important that as this commission would be reviewing reports, that it's seeing the reports along the line from the different areas, because there's so many different things that impact water, and water policy can have an impact along the way.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fisher. Well, I guess I don't have another question, but I do have a comment, and my comment is, this is the point. We've got the Environmental Quality Board, the Board of Water and Resources, the Pollution Control Agency, and the Department of Natural Resources that all deal with water policy issues. That's the problem. We've got a system in place where we've got a government that is too big, that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. Think about that. We've got four different agencies all dealing with water policy reports, and instead of trying to consolidate these issues into one area, we instead decide to add another level of government to look at all these water policy reports. And so I guess maybe next year we'll put another another layer in where we can review, we can compare the water policy report of this commission versus the water policy reports of the other four commissions. And I just don't understand the thinking. I don't understand the rationale of why we would continue to grow government when we essentially just said we've got different areas of water policy in each area of government, and to me this is just ridiculous. If there's an issue, because we've got the agencies don't know what each other's doing, which doesn't surprise me because we don't have any policy in place, and apparently we're going to repeal the policy that we've started, or the commission that we've started that would be able to deal with these issues. Instead of actually dealing with the issues, we are now going to just grow the make a bad problem much worse by hiring more staff and by coming up with a commission that's going to look at the reports of four different bloated government agencies. And it's very disturbing to me, and I really hope people at home take notice of what's going on here, because I don't see how growing more government and providing less accountability, less transparency, is going to solve any problems. It's going to cost a lot more, but it's not going to be helpful to anybody in the state of Minnesota. So, Representative Fisher, I know you're a new member, and, you know, I've been here a long time and have been frustrated at the complete lack of ability of the legislature to be able to get at these overlapping functions of government, and, you know, perhaps after you've been here a few years, you'll see how much government overlaps and be more willing to shrink it instead of growing it and creating more redundancy and expense to the taxpayers of Minnesota.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, I'm sorry I came in a little bit late on this, but my questions, I think, kind of deal to the text of the bill, and a couple questions for you. First of all, the Legislative Water Commission, looking at the makeup of this, how's the leadership of that commission going to be established, the chair and the vice chair? The bill is silent on that.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Mr. O'Driscoll, when you're asking leadership as to chair, vice chair, in terms of what parties are being done by or how it's all being set up, terms, that type of thing?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For example, in this commission, Representative Nelson's the chair and Representative Freiberg's the vice chair of this. And with our commissions, we also have chairs and vice chairs. And sometimes they're appointed by leadership, sometimes they're elected by their members, and sometimes there's other outside influences that would help to select those. And the bill is silent, and I just wonder if you'd shed some light on that for me.
Representative Fisher, but my understanding is if it's not specified in the language, it's up to the members of the commission of how they appoint who is going to be the chair of the committee. Representative Fisher, if you want to answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, what I'm doing is trying to follow what we had in force in the past. And what we want to try to do is leave as much information and control for the group to themselves to find within themselves the best way to run their organization, instead of trying to say you're going to have this person appointed here, this person appointed there. We want to allow some flexibility for the Legislative Water Commission, trying to make sure that we're not micromanaging them as much as possible.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Representative Fisher, I appreciate that because I was actually kind of in the same seat you were this time last session with the School Trust Land Commission, and we were very explicit as to how the membership was going to be put together, and we actually in statute gave the authority to the members to select their leadership from the members. We felt it was less political that way. So you may want to consider an amendment to that point if that's what your intentions are, is trying to accomplish that. Mr. Chair, I do have another question. With that, I also learned last year when I was working to establish and bring about the Land Trust Commission that we have this thing called fiscal notes, because there's dollars and cents that are connected to these kinds of things. And I don't see where there was a fiscal note or there was anything on here relative to the staffing requirements of that commission.
And Representative O'Driscoll, that question was asked earlier, and Representative Fisher can answer it again, but we're not a fiscal committee, and I believe they've got a preliminary fiscal note, and there will be one once this gets to Ways and Means, where it'll have to go. There will be a fiscal note there, and then the Finance Committee that has to go to. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm certainly just trying to give a new incoming freshman the benefit of my wisdom from being a freshman last year and some of the stumbling blocks on this. And my comments shouldn't be construed as though I'm supporting the Legislative Water Commission. They do have some other questions on that, and at this point I'll defer if there's others on the list before I would start asking some of those technical-related questions.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. Maybe Representative Fisher, you can answer this, or I see Mr. Hubinger's here. Maybe he can help out. But on line 1.19 and 2.0 and 2.1, it says the Legislative Water Commission may appoint and fix the compensation of personnel and consultants necessary to enable the commission to carry out its functions. I'm just curious, is this the normal way that these commissions are staffed? I expect this is handled by the LCC itself. Representative Fisher?
Fisher. If you want to phone a friend.
It'd be nice to phone a friend. And Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, what we were doing is we were picking up the language that had been used when this commission was in operation before. But I'm open to if there's better ways to do it. And phoning
a
friend
here. Mr. Hubinger's here, and welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. The language in this proposal is similar to some of the other commissions where they have their own authority to hire staff. There's general statutory authority for the LCC to approve all salaries for all joint legislative staff, so that would govern when staff for this commission were hired.
Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that answers the question. Thank you, Mr. Hubinger. Representative Fisher, I have the same concerns and frustrations with this bill as Representative Pepin shared. Another question I have relates to the data included in this bill. On page 2, we talk about the ability for the commission to secure data, and that data or information compiled by the commission shall be made available. Is the plan for this bill to be heard in civil law, and has it been heard yet there?
Representative Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, from my understanding right now, there is nothing that would have it going to civil law. From what I was understanding, that the need was to, for the path of the bill was to come through here and then to rules, and from there the route will be open as to where it goes. Was wondering what your concerns were, why it would need to go to civil law.
Representative Driscoll. My tongue's a little twisted.
Chair, I appreciate the additional attention, but for the record, these are Representative Draskowski's comments.
And Representative Driscoll, you have not announced for governor yet, have you?
Not to my knowledge.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of... Representative Fisher, the Civil Law Committee handles data practices information and handles the... security and access of the people to data that's handled by government, and so that's the reason that this bill appears that it needs to go there, and so that's why I asked the question. Mr. Chair, I would hope that that we can take this bill to civil law so that they get a chance to properly vet the bill
Well, Representative Driscoll, we're sending it to rules, and then rules will send it where they need to send it. And I'm sure that they will. It'll take whatever course it needs to take to get it to fruition.
Mr. Chair, another question for Representative Fisher, if I could.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. The bottom of page 1, you talk about the very last sentence, and I haven't seen this language before, but that doesn't mean it's not in our voluminous sets of statute that have been created by these legislatures. Says state employees subject to civil service laws and rules who may be assigned to the commission shall retain civil service status without interruption or loss of status or privilege. I'm curious about what you sensed as the need to include that there, and that, you know, it seems the fact that it's there says to me, at least as I read that, that there's an expectation that employees in this commission are going to be current government employees, ostensibly in the executive branch, in one of the four agencies that are included here.
Representative Fisher, and I don't see Mr. Hubinger. Well, there he is.
He's here.
He's hiding back there.
I'm phoning a friend on this one.
And maybe Mr. Shepard might know, or Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Shepard, Chair and members, I think Representative Fisher indicated that he had drafted this language based on a prior statute that created a legislative water commission, and my guess is that this language is from there. It's probably not common language anymore because there have been interagency agreements and just other methods of providing for if employees of the executive branch want to come work here on a temporary basis. There's generally ways to do that now that we're in recent years we haven't seen this kind of language in statute.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. Wondering if the author would be receptive to an amendment to delete that last sentence.
Representative Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, yes, I would be open to deleting that language.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Mr. Chair, I'd move that amendment if we could.
So, Representative Driscoll, I think I'll get Mr. Shepard to what you're talking at on line, starting at line 1.22, starting with state and through line 1.24, deleting that. I guess if that's, I'll have Mr. Shepard read that back.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would be on line 1.22 to delete state employees subject, and then to delete lines 1.23 and 1.24.
Is that what your intent is, Representative Driscoll?
It is, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Does everybody understand the amendment? So all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
the motion's adopted, or the motion's approved and the amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair, one last thing.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fisher, for the discussion. Members, I share, as I mentioned, the same concerns that Representative Pepin mentioned. We have here something that I haven't seen before, and maybe I don't know how this commission operated when it was in statute earlier, if it operated the same or differently, but it appears that we are asking the executive branch to bring forward the information and ideas of government, to capture those ideas and bring them into the legislature for enactment of essentially into law. And I struggle with the approach. The legislature is supposed to be a representative of the people, and the ideas and direction of the legislature is supposed to be derived from them rather than the government, and this seems to run perfectly contrary to that. I struggle with this, and I would encourage you to vote no on this particular bill. Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call if I could.
Roll call has been asked for. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was just kind of at a parliamentary question that since we took an amendment that hadn't been posted for 24 hours, I'm assuming that's with the chair's discretion and because the author of the bill and the author of the amendment agreed.
It was a simple oral amendment.
It was a simple oral amendment. Okay, thank you.
It wasn't a complicated amendment. Okay. Any further questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to Representative Tice. She also raised her hand, and she hasn't had a chance, to my knowledge, to speak on the bill. So,
Representative Tice, we'll go with you first then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, I know that when there's a construction project, most of the boards and agencies that are listed here require a permit, so there's a lot of duplicative permitting process that we go through. So will this commission affect that permitting process?
Representative Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the purpose of this commission is trying to make sure that as we're doing water policy in the future, that we're doing good water policy and taking the time to be able to do it in the off session in a bipartisan way so that we can move things effectively going forward. If one of the things that they look at is how permitting occurs in that process in relation to water, that might be a possibility, but it's not something that's being set up in such a way to require agencies necessarily to change how they're permitting. The primary focus of this is to allow better gathering of information and discussion of the issues on water amongst us as legislature, as legislators, so that we're able to come out with better law and policy as we go forward that we can forward off to the executive branch to execute for us.
Representative Tice.
Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This question might be to both Mr. Fisher and or to Representative Fisher, excuse me, and to Mr. Shepard. This language we're looking at today is language from a previous commission or a previous attempt at creating a commission from a previous bill.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, this was a commission that was in operation for a number of years. And what we're doing here is taking the language that had primarily been used when that commission was operating in the past, and because it worked well before, is taking what was working well and just modifying what we need as we go forward to try to bring this tool back into use for us.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, Representative Fisher, I do apologize if you covered some of this information prior to my being here, my tardiness. But do you know the reasons why the commission had been discontinued previously and maybe some background on that?
Representative Fisher.
I know a little bit of the information, and I think there's a person here in the audience who can give a little bit more background if I could phone a friend in.
I see somebody coming down to the podium and... Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities, and it's a definite sign when you're the one person in the room who was around when the commission was still around. Legislative Water Commission was around for a long time. It was formed as part of the Groundwater Protection Act work that was done in the late 80s through the early 90s. In the mid-90s, there was an attempt by the legislature to demonstrate government frugality and efficiency, This used to be very standard on any issues that were highly complex and controversial. There were legislative commissions. Groups of legislators from both bodies would meet in the summer. Agency staff would be brought in to answer questions and present information. The staff for the commission was an employee of the legislature, not of the administrative branch. And they would then take that information and kind of do the detailed kinds of hearings that we very seldom have time to do during the legislative session. And when session came up, there'd be five members in the House and five members of the Senate that really understood the issues and could kind of give a recommendation of what to do in their committees. At that point, virtually all the legislative commissions were abolished except for the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, which was changed to be the LCCMR now, and the Legislative Audit Commission. And most of the others at that time were abolished, just kind of pro forma. All of them were eliminated as a government efficiency move at that time.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for the background. You've piqued my interest on a few things. The duties and oversight that those that not all, I'll just keep it to the Legislative Water Commission. That's what we're here today. Did any of those duties or any of those activities get delegated, relegated, or other to the Environmental Quality Board, Board of Water and Soil Resources, Pollution Control Agency, Department of Natural Resources, or were any of those agencies created as a result of a discontinuation of the Legislative Water Commission?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. They all pre-exist that. In fact, there used to be more environmental agencies at that point. What this really is, is the legislature has dozens and dozens of reports that they have mandated state agencies do every year. When those reports come in, our committees at the legislature, as you know, really don't have time to go through all those reports. So part of that is just making sure that when the legislature is asking our agencies to provide data, that somebody is actually looking at that and critiquing it and bringing it back to the legislature a little more digested than we would get if you just hand the report out in committee that's 64 pages long and nobody really goes over it. So. But nothing, when this committee left, all it meant is that if we want to discuss complex environmental issues on water, it now happens in the legislative committees only, not during an interim hearing process. This was almost all work done during the interim.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, you also represent the largest group of collective municipalities in the state of Minnesota through the League of Minnesota Cities. Does the League have a position on this or any background that would be a benefit to the committee while making our decisions through deliberations?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, the League has been supportive of this commission being reformed because of the cost and complexity that water regulations bring to our municipalities and the need that we feel there is for a much better understanding of some of those issues in the legislature. We think this would help that tremendously. I can also add that the state chapter of the American Water Works Association in Minnesota, which is the folks who do drinking water and groundwater supply in this state, have supported reforming this group for 5 years now.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one final.
Representative O'Driscoll.
It's more of a comment than it is maybe a question. I know that in other committees, and it's come before this as well, the sunsetting of the Sunset Commission, it looks like that or some derivative of that might be helpful to streamlining Minnesota state government for all the reasons that were stated here today as well. So just a comment and an observation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Anybody from the audience that needs to speak to or against the bill? If not, Representative, I renew my motion that House File 1769, as amended, be passed and re-referred to the Rules Committee. And the roll call being asked for, the clerk will take the roll. I almost forgot.
Nelson?
Aye.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Dorholt?
Yes.
Piskowski?
No.
Falk?
Aye.
Hansen?
Hansen?
Yes. Kahn?
Aye.
Lean?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pugh?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Tice?
Nope.
Winkler?
Yes.
Viewing 8 ayes and 6 nays, the motion is passed or the motion is approved, or the motion is passed, the bill is approved. Thank you, Representative Fisher.
Thank you very much, committee.
The next bill on our committee agenda today is House File 1740. Representative Fordenstein, welcome back to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And there are two amendments to the bill. Are these both your amendments, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So I'll move House File 1740 be recommended to pass and be referred to rules. And we have the A1. Do you want to do them in order? Or
sure.
We'll do the A1 amendment. Can you explain what that amendment does?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. This just simply cleans up some language, specifies the definition of minimum guarantee county. We can get into that more in the bill. The second part that deals with the GEARS Committee of the County Transit Improvement Board and delineates some of the responsibilities that are new in my bill.
So I'll move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wants. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's approved. The motion's approved. The amendment's adopted. Then the A2 amendment, and what does this do?
Mr. Chairman and members, this is just simply, we don't know if there will be a metro sales tax, number one, and we also don't know what the rate would be. So this takes out language that presumes the rate of the tax.
So that's the blank.
Yeah.
I move the House File, that the A2 amendment to House File 1740 be recommended to pass. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion's approved. The amendment's adopted. Now, Representative Hornstein, please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is putting in place a structure, governance structure, for the possible imposition of a metro sales tax dedicated towards transit and transitway development in the region. This is a part of the governor's budget plan. It's currently not in play in the House, but in case this becomes part of end of session discussions, I wanted to make sure that there was a committee of the House that heard this governance structure and was familiar with it, could ask questions, could give me advice and suggestions about it, and that's why we're here on your very last meeting, Mr. Chairman. Again, we're not talking about the actual tax here. We're talking about how it would be governed. And according to, legislation that had been prepared and is still potentially on the table, there would be envisioned in the governor's plan a additional half-cent sales tax imposed in the metro area on the five counties that have approved a local option quarter cent sales tax. So it would raise their tax to 0.75 cents, and then there would be additional tax imposed on Scott and Carver County that are currently not part of the County Transit Improvement Board, and that would be at a rate of 0.75 cents. So the challenge then is, how would this then be levied, and how would it be governed? Currently, we have a structure in place in the metropolitan area that involves a quarter cent sales tax that five counties are currently imposing for the purpose of transitway development. And members, this happened as a result of the transportation bill that was passed in 2008. And the reason why the counties in the metropolitan area are levying this transitway funding authority is because at that time the Metropolitan Council did not want that authority. Governor Pawlenty and the chairman of the Met Council at the time, Peter Bell, were very clear that they did not want this particular taxing authority. And so in negotiations with the Metropolitan Council and the legislature, legislature created what's called the Counties Transit Improvement Board, otherwise known as CTIP. And CTIB was charged then in that 2008 legislation with the authority to collect and levy the tax, and as a local option. And what's important for this committee, Mr. Chairman, is that there then was a governance structure for the counties that was established, because we're dealing with a joint powers board and multiple counties. And I thought the counties came up with a very helpful and creative solution, which is, again, to create a board that had representatives from all five counties, as well as the, some Met Council representation. And those counties then had a weighted voting system that was determined by population and sales tax capacity. And it's worked very, very well. This has been a very, very successful model of intergovernment cooperation. And what we're doing here is simply tweaking the structure to accommodate these two extra counties that would be part of this now county board, as well as giving a little bit more authority for cities. Now that this is now a sales tax imposed regionally, we wanted cities to have a little bit more authority, and so they're going to get a small amount of the sales tax to use at their discretion. You know, we envision for sort of bike and pedestrian projects primarily, but also some planning for other transit functions. So what House File 1740 does essentially is add Scott and Carver to the governing board for the counties, and gives a little bit more authority to cities to have to make some grants for these additional projects that would be available under this new newly collected metro sales tax. So again, we're simply dealing with the governance. And I'd say the third part of the bill deals with the fact that we envision the Metropolitan Council also, you know, benefiting from this tax, and we set up a structure where the Metropolitan Council will get money for their operations, CTIB would continue to get money for transitways, and then there would be some discretionary money which both CTIB and the Met Council would agree to in terms of how it's delved out under a joint certification process. And that, again, has a lot of transparency, because both would have to come forward publicly with very detailed budget plans and how they would use the money. And then that would be a subject of negotiations. If those don't work, then there would be legislative oversight of that. And I think both the Met Council and CTIB would prefer not to have this go to the legislature. So there's a real incentive for them to kind of work things out through this joint certification process. So those are the three governance pieces that are change items, if you will, from the status quo, and would be part of this process. I'll also say one last thing with regard to the Metropolitan Council. It is envisioned that with the collection of a metropolitan sales tax, there would be less general fund money available for Met Council operations. So that's why you know, we envision that the sales tax would be used both for the Met Council operations as well as transitway development in the region. So that, thank you, Mr. Chair, that's the bill. Or at least the government operations aspects of the bill, not the tax committee.
Representative O'Driscoll. Of the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, this is your third or maybe fourth appearance before the Operations Commission. It's like the last 2 years when you were with us on the, on the committee. I know that this is being taken out of sequence and after deadline. It's going to rules. Do we know what the anticipated committees are going to be after this? And the reason I ask that is the bill is entitled Metropolitan Transit Tax Authority and then Joint Powers, and it seems like we're kind of further down the list than that, where the committee that's here hearing it first. I'm just wondering if tax or others were going to be hearing this.
Representative O'Driscoll, we'll send it to rules, and as I said on the earlier bill, the rules will send it where it needs to go. Representative Hornstein, do you know where it's going to go from rules, where you anticipate it going?
This would be subject to an evolving process on the transportation bill. We don't know yet what if this will be included or not. We also don't know if there'll be what additional things may be added as it relates to road and bridge funding. And so, you know, we would this would probably go to rules, and then I imagine back to the taxes and or transportation.
So, Representative Hornstein, you're covering yourself on your transportation
finance bill in case this gets put into that, that it's met our hearing process about the government operations piece.
Correct. The reason this is, thank you, Mr. Chairman, the reason this is before government operations is this is a government operations piece of a larger potential transportation finance bill.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since we do want to limit this to the scope of this commission, or committee rather, in the 12-page bill, could you point out the sections that are relative to this committee as we're doing our work here today?
Well, Representative O'Driscoll, other than the tax parts of it, it's the setting up of the board and their powers and changing of the board that deals with us, and I don't. It's scattered throughout most of the bill. The tax piece of it, as far as what the level of that tax is going to be at, and maybe Mr. Shepherd might have a better answer than that. But the tax part of it is not our purview. That's why there was a blank in that amendment for the taxes, because we don't know what that's going to be, and we don't set that. So I don't think if Mr. Shepherd has can be better of that, because it's most of this, like I said, is setting up the board and the powers and how they're supposed to operate. Most of the bill is our purview. Representative, or Mr. Shepherd, don't want to demote you.
Mr. Chair and members, I think Representative Hornstein indicated on page 3 that there's provisions that add the other two counties to the bill and refer to all counties in the metropolitan area. So I think that that may, I'm going to, Mr. Chair, I should phone a friend, because one of my colleagues is telling, shaking his head no.
I see Mr. Gehring is coming to the... Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Burris,
that's right.
Mr. Burris. Chair and members of the committee, I'm the other Matt Burris with House Research. Mr. Shepherd was pointing out actually a provision that, if I understand correctly, the A2 amendment was adopted, so that provision adding other counties was removed from the underlying bill. The general thrust of the bill, as Representative Hornstein pointed out, refers to powers and decision-making of both the county's Transit Improvement Board and the Metropolitan Council, and the process that they would go through in developing a joint certification of a portion of funds from potential additional sales tax revenues. That would be probably one of the broad areas that could be considered by the committee. The other thing that might be worth noting is on the A1 amendment, there is a change introduced that would empower a subcommittee within CTIB known as the Gears Committee, which normally or historically has been established to evaluate possible grants and provide input to the larger CTIB board about use of funds. The modification made in the A1 amendment, along with the language that's in the underlying bill, is to provide that Gears Committee with additional decision-making authority on use of funds that would not need to go through the board. So a portion of total sales tax revenues would be allocated to the Gears Committee for grants that committee would make for planning grants to cities, as well as for bicycle and pedestrian uses. On the A1 amendment, the bulk of that language starts on page 1, line 17.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was kind of just hoping that in the bill I could get the line number so I could look in there. We've had two nice overviews on that, but I just kind of want to see the working mechanisms of the structure and those kinds of things. I was just hoping to be able to kind of sit back and review those. So what I was able to gather, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it looks like page 3, subdivision 5, page 4, subdivision 5A, all of page 4, all of page 5, page 6, page 7, and into the top of page 8. But when we get to section 2, which is really the taxing authority, it would look like to the end of that is not within the purview of this committee, that would be taxes. So about half the bill would be taxes. Is that a pretty good assessment as to the nature of the...
It's Representative O'Driscoll, that's kind of how I look at it, but also you look at, we're talking about how the Met Council uses the funds, and that would be our purview as far as with the authority we give them, I believe. Could be wrong. But yeah, most of the bill, other than the tax portions of it, are our purview.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hornstein. As a member who represents Carver County, 30% of my district is Carver County, I have a number of questions and concerns about this. I believe my questions are germane to this particular committee and the governance and CTIB. I'm wondering, number one, if you could clarify for me this weighted voting system and how members from Carver County would, you know, how, to what degree are we going to be able to weigh in?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And
I see he's phoning a friend. So.
Representative Pugh. Well, and I just wanted to be clear on the amendment, since the tax isn't imposed, you know, this is a little bit of a nuance here, but because I think your question is valid, because we do envision Carver County entering this. We took, since we're not imposing a tax, we can't add Carver County at this time. So that's right. Part of what the amendment did. However, it's a very fair question. It should be on the table. And I'm going to ask Commissioner McLaughlin to answer that.
And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Peter McLaughlin. I'm chair of the county's Transit Improvement Board and a member of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, the weighted voting system for CTIB is established, and the votes are allocated currently among five counties, and they would be allocated among seven counties plus the metropolitan counties. So there are 100 votes total. Five votes go to the Metropolitan Council. The 95 remaining votes are allocated among the five, and it would be among the seven if the tax were to be imposed under this bill. And they are allocated based on a 50-50 weighting of the population of the county and the sales tax generated within the particular county. So you get a weighting from that, and then the 95 votes are allocated in that fashion.
Okay. Representative Pugh, and I guess she also asked how that would affect Carver County if they were brought into this. And I guess you may or may not know the answer to that. How many votes, how that would the votes would shake out if the two additional counties were added.
Mr. Chairman, the votes, Scott and Carver, between the two counties, have less than 10% of the population of the seven county metro area, and less than 5% of the sales tax revenue. So the numbers of votes in Carver would be on the order of 3, is my recollection. I don't have the chart with me. I can look it up on my BlackBerry.
Representative Pugh,
that's the order of magnitude.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. I had a feeling that it would be a very small percentage, but again, as a representative of a county that has not been included in this in the past, in fact, I've been a resident of Carver County for 25 years. We chose to build in Carver County versus Hennepin County for the reason of taxes, and when I say this, I'm speaking on behalf of the vast majority of my constituents. They're concerned about this potential sales tax, and I'm very concerned about wanting to ensure that we are, you know, just well represented, have a voice. I'm specifically concerned about, I don't know, I guess this would be my question after I'm done making my comment, but wondering if you or if there's anyone else here who could give me assurance that, for example, the Southwest Metro Transit, I'm not sure if it's Southwest Transit, but, you know, we've got a great opt-out service in our district, and the light rail does not come into Carver County. So I have yet to meet a constituent that thinks that this is a good investment, and I'm struggling with, you know, what to say to them, and, you know, myself included. So any assurances that you could give me about us being able to maintain, really hang on to the level of service that we have through Southwest Transit would be appreciated.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, those are concerns that we have dealt with in the past. Washington County raised some of those same concerns when CTIB was created in 2008. They didn't have projects that were as far along, and so we created this notion of the minimum guarantee county and a guaranteed a portion of the tax generated in Washington County, and the idea here would be a portion of the tax generated in Scott and Carver County would be guaranteed to those counties. So 55% in the amendment, 55% of the first quarter of a percent of the sales tax would be guaranteed to be used in Carver County. And we have provided in the past with Washington County, and we would do with Carver County and Scott in the future, for this five-year period, there would be more flexibility on the use of the funds. You'd be able to do planning. You could do subsidization, providing help to Southwest Transit, for example, for express bus service to your community. So it's a set of questions that we've actually tackled in the past. Washington County has been a full participant using those kinds of special provisions that didn't apply in the other four counties that were in CTIP. And it was in direct recognition of some of the same conditions that are in Carver today, which is you don't have a big project that's set and ready to go, but you do have transit service that you need to try to build on.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that response. I'm still not completely satisfied. My thought is, you mentioned that there would be this dedicated percentage of the revenue that would be generated from Carver County that would go back into. Would that be incremental over and above the way it's distributed right now? Obviously, there's some funding that is given to the opt-out, to Southwest Transit, and so would this be over and above that? And are we talking two things here? Are we talking about this GEARS program that funds bike paths and pedestrian?
No, we're,
I'm a little confused.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Commissioner.
Representative Pugh, this would be money that would be over and above the allocation that Southwest Transit receives from the Metropolitan Council for the transit operation. So this would be new money, and it would be set aside. It's not the GEARS money that has to do with bike and ped. This could be used for express bus service, for example.
Thank you.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm satisfied.
Any further questions? Anybody from the audience? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a chance to review the sections that were in, and then I just have a couple questions for the author, if you would.
Sure. Representative O'Driscoll.
In the A1 amendment, Representative Hornstein, in lines 1.4 on the inserted language from that's in place of the language that was struck, it says, for grants awarded in calendar years 2014 through 2018, is this anticipated to have a five-year authorization in life of this commission committee that we're talking about today?
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, it doesn't sunset, but what would happen is, I think, as these transitways are built out, what I like about this plan is that it accelerates this build-out, so that rather than having this very piecemeal approach that I think creates a lot of instability and uncertainty in our planning process, what the sales tax will do is create a lot of certainty and accelerate the build-out. And so once that we have, for example, let's say a new transitway is built in Carver County or in Scott County or some of these other lines that are envisioned in our plan are built out, we would see a shift from the transitway capital portion of this plan towards operations. And so this is anticipating that, these guaranteed counties will still be able to, as this transition occurs between capital and operations, these new counties would still be able to receive this, for the initial startup period, which would last a pretty long time. I mean, from now till 2018.
Representative Driscoll, and I believe that that's what Commissioner McLaughlin was talking about, that they're guaranteed if they get brought in and that tax is imposed, that they'd be guaranteed a percentage of this money up front so they could use it and more flexibility in using it. Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah. Oh, Mr. Chair, that wasn't really the nature of the question. It was just the duration of time, because it does say from 2014 through 2018. That was more Representative Hornsby is more to the point on the answer of, okay, so then that's the capital phase, and then it's going to shift to an operation phase. Would you need to, Representative Hornstein, have to come back and ask for legislative approval to continue with capital, or it would just shift to operations? What's the governance mechanism.
Representative Bornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Driscoll. So that's a very good point, because that's why we have this joint certification process, because these monies will shift over time. And so we need both the Met Council and CTIP to be a little nimble in terms of how they're planning and allocating for that money. So we have a very transparent process where, 50% of the sales, approximately 50% of the sales tax pool would then be subject to this joint certification process, where the Met Council and CTIP would be negotiating, essentially, the allocation between capital and operations. And so, again, that it shifts over time, but, would be subject to this transparent negotiation.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to ask for a roll call.
Roll call being asked for. Anybody else in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? If not, any more further questions? We'll take a roll call. Clerk will take the roll. I'll renew my motion that House File 1740, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to rules. Roll call.
Nelson?
Aye.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Dorholt?
Aye.
Juskowski?
No.
Falk?
Aye.
Hansen?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Ween?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Hugh?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Tice?
No.
Winkler?
Yes.
The six ayes and, or five, excuse me, eight ayes and six nays. The motion is approved. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative
Hornstein. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
The next bill on our agenda is House File 1775, Representative Kahn. Representative Kahn, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move 1775.
And it needs to go to rules.
Yes.
And Representative Kahn, there's an amendment. Is this your amendment, or is this Representative Hansen's amendment? And
Representative Hansen's amendment. If,
I'll move the amendment. I'll move the A1 amendment.
I can move the A1 amendment. I'll move the A1 amendment.
Representative Kahn moves the A1 amendment.
Amendment that has brought great peace in the valley, so to speak. Peace along the river, I guess we have to say at this point.
You want to describe the amendment then?
Yes. 1775 is in the legacy bill, because this came from a previous legacy appointment. This came for an issue of for administration of the Mississippi River Corridor Critical Area Program. When I first said it should come into the bill, I actually thought it was a very minor thing that we were doing. We had a large amount of this bill was this was law at the time, and there was a rulemaking process of which the time had run out for the rulemaking process. And so I thought that was a very easy thing to do. We ran into a little bit of a buzzsaw with several sets of people. It turns out that there were many people who were having problems with this. The thing that we really went into was we ran into problems with the St. Paul delegation, and we ran which had and some of the St. Paul businesses, which thought that the line, it wasn't necessarily the rules which had stopped, but they thought that the language in the bill, that the language that was already in statute, was much too restrictive, and were really and was not friendly to the industry that was already in place or going in place along the city. So with much discussions, and I know that Mr. Meyer is here from DNR, Representative Dill was involved in this, Representative Hansen was involved in this, people from St. Paul were involved in this, the language, they decided that we needed to really look at the development along the river, in the cities, and along the area, and we needed to take out, even though, as Representative Hansen said, this had originally passed through 9 separate committees when it had passed, we had to, this kind of very, very prescriptive language had to come out. And, you know, as someone who's just been a bystander watching this go on, all I can say is, as I understand it, there's an agreement between all of the people. This is being carried in the legacy bill. This is the issue we've come, the policy issue that it was really needed to deal with was the question of rulemaking in the GovOps committee. And I just wish that we'd pass this on. It will be carried in the legacy bill.
So Representative Conwell, Representative Pepin. So I have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, sorry.
Yeah.
Wondering if the DNR could come up at this time. I'm in Texas across the way, and I know a vote's coming up quickly, and so I really want to be here for both. But my question to DNR is, I'm very concerned about this this language and what it would do to one of my communities, Dayton, and also what it would mean for other cities on the Mississippi, such as anywhere in that area, represented by Representative Portman or Representative Abler or Representative Uglum, all along that way. And if you could let me know what exactly this means for those cities and their potential for development and redevelopment.
Mr. Meyer, please state your name for the
members paper. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. And just really quickly, first of all, to the bill 1775, the language notwithstanding 14.125, this is a section of law that's in Chapter 14 that often catches the DNR rulemaking off guard, so to speak. It provides that the rulemaking has to be completed within 18 months. To do a good job on a big rule such as this, it takes years to do, right? So that's why we're back here. We lost our rulemaking authority because the rulemaking took longer than 18 months to accomplish, because we wanted to have a complete kind of an exhaustive public stakeholder process. So to go back to your original question, Representative Pepin, the changes within the amendment here that you see 2.12, 2.20 to 2.22, and explicitly the language on 3.18, where the original bill was overly prescriptive, so to speak, on these floodplain setbacks, 12 to 18% slopes, things like that, 18 and greater. We would go back and rewind the tape, so to speak, on this rulemaking process to a certain degree, and speak on this rulemaking process to a certain degree, and begin the public stakeholder input process over again, using what we have with LIDAR imagery now, which is laser data, that laser image data reference points. So we have exact topography maps of all of these bluffs and go back and work with those local communities so that we can help them be more consistent, deal with some of the conflicts that are there, wild and scenic, the critical area, places such as that where there are shoreland ordinances, where it becomes really confusing on some of those things. So I view this, Representative Pepin, as removing the conflict and helping us get to a set of rules, a rule that is doing what we need to do, protecting these areas right now and into the future, as that there are, most of them are already developed. It's the redevelopment that will occur that we're trying to get at as well. So we will be working with all stakeholders, local governments, local units of government, cities, municipalities, to make sure that their concerns are addressed, and also work with the stakeholders, the environmental organizations, and to get to a rule that we believe will provide the protections we need, but also allow for that sustainable economic growth in these regions.
Representative Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kahn and Mr. Meyer. I'm frustrated because this bill apparently was introduced on 4/15 and it's now 4/17, which it doesn't even make the 3-day requirement, which means that I don't believe there's enough transparency. And I attempted to contact my city today to find out how this impacted them. And in a scramble, of course, they weren't aware that this was coming up because of the rather short notice. I just want to read you something that my mayor, who's very concerned, said, and I want you to, if you could comment on it, and also wondering if...
And Representative Pepin, you can read that, but the bill was introduced, it looks like 4/12, and the amendment is 4/15, but...
Well, Mr. Chair, the bill that I have in front of me says House File Number 1775, 4/15/2013.
Yours says 4/15. Mine says 4/12.
It will.
Yeah.
Representative Kahn.
It says both.
It says both?
It says 4/12 at the top and then 4/15.
That's the timestamp. That's
okay,
the timestamp, Mr. Chair.
I looked at the wrong line. Never mind.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, this is what my city had to say, and it's a couple paragraphs, but just because this, I haven't had a chance to fully speak with them and talk to them about their concerns, and I'm certainly not an expert in this area. This is what they had to say. Said, the city of Dayton would be adamantly opposed to the current version of the legislation. It contains no reference to the jurisdiction of the local government and seems to remove all local authority from the local unit of government. With this legislation in place, the city of Dayton would not be able to negotiate with developers to get the kind of development the residents of Dayton would want, and it would result in the sort of development the commissioner would want, a commissioner who's never set foot in the community. The potential impact runs far deeper than just the corridor in which the jurisdiction resides. Sewer, water, and stormwater systems would potentially be affected citywide as those systems either pass through or terminate within the legislated area. Also, without clear standards in place for the vagueness of this legislation, acts as a deterrent to even begin the costly process of exploring development by developers. In short, the vagueness of the legislation combined with the total stripping of control from the local unit of government makes this legislation the kiss of death for development in our city. And I would say and the city isn't fully developed, and just wondering if you could comment on that. And then I guess my second follow-up question would be to Representative Kahn, and if you've had a chance to speak to some of these other legislators about this, because clearly my city would like to have time to comment on this, and they're the kiss of death for development. That's pretty concerning to me, especially with such short notice.
Well, Representative Kahn, and
let me take a step first.
And
first
Representative
of all,
Kahn, I think Representative Hansen, who's okay. Whose amendment is that you moved is maybe a help answer too if you need the help. But Representative Kahn,
yes, okay. But first of all, you know, there are these restrictions. Some of these things are already in place by an executive order that was put in by Governor Quay, which actually still exists because it was never repealed. This is taking out the things that your city is probably most, the Hansen Amendment, and maybe we ought to bring him up too. He's much more informed and involved about this than I am. I think it takes out all the things that your city would really have been concerned about. It puts it back into a rulemaking process, as Mr. Meyer discussed, that will be much more amenable to everything else. Remember, this amendment is getting rid of existing state law. These are the things. And if you go back to the existing executive order, there's a lot of authority to be doing these things, which actually could have been done. It's, you know, it is, as Mr. Meyer said, winding back the clock and going in with the proper involvement of local units of government and appropriately setting the kind of rules that we'll all live by. I'll put another side piece in there for a bill that was introduced even later. It's House File 1776, I believe. I keep getting confused if it's 75 or 76, which I put in this is 1775. So it's 1776, which calls on the Metropolitan Council to develop a model urban rivers ordinance, which is one of the things that one of my constituents brought to me. Is very, with all due respects to DNR, whom I sometimes just love and sometimes can't stand, but DNR, the belief that DNR does not really understand urban rivers, and it doesn't understand what it takes to make the river in Minneapolis or St. Paul, I'm not too sure about Dayton, look more like the Seine than look like Seine in Paris or the Arno in Florence or something like that, then look like a trout stream in southeast Minnesota or northern Minnesota. So we really want this whole discussion of what we want urban rivers to do. Whereas setbacks might be the most important thing that we might have for a natural river. Instead of these urban rivers, the most important thing is to have, like a riverside restaurant or a marina that's, absolutely right there, or houseboats being able to, a housing boat thing as they have in Seattle and in Portland, Oregon. So we want that kind of discussion to take place. This is just what, I'd like to let Mr. Meyer say something and also bring Mr. Hansen up or let him talk from where he is.
Well, Representative Hansen, if you want to weigh in on your amendment and... That's what we're describing. Had the amendments been moved, but we haven't voted on it yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I apologize. I'd had to run into the other committee. And I think just catching a bit of this, I'd had an oral amendment that I think would help address some of those concerns that we, because of the timing, we did not get involved. And that was on line 1.22.
And Representative Hansen, what would be your oral amendment?
It was, where you see development stricken and then redevelopment, I would insert development and redevelopment, two words, on line 1.2 after the word and before the word redevelopment. So it would read, provides for continuation and development and redevelopment of a variety of urban uses.
So, Representative Hansen, you're restoring the stricken language development and adding and between development and redevelopment.
And I would move that if that's proper. That was my... Or I could incorporate it into...
Yeah. Representative Kahn incorporates that into her amendment.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair, to speak to the amendment.
Representative Pepin,
you were in the... Rules Committee this morning, and in the legacy finance bill, there is a provision relating to continuing the rulemaking that was authorized in 2009 using clean water funds. That provision is really what 1775 is without the appropriation. What the A1 amendment with the incorporation is an attempt to resolve some of the concerns that were raised in 2009 and have been raised since then on the prescriptive nature of the statute that provides the rulemaking. So what is being done in the amendment is going back to the 2009 statute that authorized the rulemaking and removing the bluff language that many folks had commented and determined was too prescriptive. And that would, by removing that, and the language that references the executive order 1979, and I testified in Ways and Means last Friday that I think we need to look at the river as it is rather than in 1979. Representative Kahn is correct that we are currently operating under the executive order that was written in 1979. And I believe, and I stated in 2009, and I still believe this, using all of the technology that we have today, all of the mapping software, all of the science that we have now, we can more accurately work to protect the businesses, provide for economic development, and have a good river system because it's not 1979. We have a lot more information now that we can use to help make good decisions. And what you see, Representative Pepin, here in the A1 is pretty much what's in statute. And you see that I'm striking a lot of it. And this is information, this is statute that I authored and went through many committees, but we have invested clean water funds in developing these rules, and I think we should finish them. And I want to remove those impediments, those concerns that local governments have raised and others about the specific nature relating to the rules. I think there are people in the audience that would testify. Some probably aren't happy with what I've done in terms of removing some of these materials, removing some of these sections, and some of them are probably very happy. But that's why the bill is here in government operations. And that's what, rather than going forward with 1775 as just let's continue going, I am trying to address some of the concerns that have been raised in 09 during the rulemaking and as we've moved through this process, so that we can have a protected river, clean water, and economic development.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen. I'm wondering if Mr. Meyer could comment. And Mr. Meyer, you'll probably remember that I brought a bill forward that had to do with Dayton, the city of Dayton. And I don't have the file in front of me because with the speed of session, it's impossible to keep on top of all the bills going forward. But my recollection was that the city of Dayton basically couldn't do any development or redevelopment, and they were being kind of governed under the Mississippi River critical area, as well as some other rulemaking process. And that's why I'm concerned. They were one of only a couple of cities that were in that unique situation, which virtually prevented them from making any changes. And so I'm very concerned about the ability of the community to be able to develop and redevelop. I appreciate the Representative Hansen's change. I'm not sure that is going to fully help or solve the problem that the city of Dayton has. And I'm wondering if Mr. Meyer, if you could clarify for me and assure me that the mayor of the city, who's been very involved in this issue, is wrong in his email.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm going to bring up Director Steve Hirsch from Ecological Water Resources Division to talk about this specifically, but I was just looking at that language that passed. I believe it was the 2011 special session budget bill that contained that Senate File 3 of 2011 special session, first session. This won't change that. So actually, Director Hirsch can talk a little bit more about it, but the mayor, I don't think, has seen this language, this
yes.
amendment. The amendment?
He's seen both
okay.
the amendment. And
because
the
in my opinion, the amendment does alleviate a lot of those concerns. And I'm going to bring up Director Hirsch just to talk about what the rule that we had would have actually done for Dayton, because I think it would have solved some of those problems in the city of Dayton.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological and Water Resources Director, and Mr. Chairman, and Representative Pepin. As Mr. Meyer said, when we were drafting these rules under the previous process, we were sensitive to the issues around Dayton, and we actually created one of the new districts we created was created to make their non-conforming structures and lots conforming. So we were trying to address the issue that then was subsequently addressed in legislation. And actually, there were a number of other examples in the draft rules where we tried to do that, where we tried to, take existing nonconformities and when we made the new districts, make sure that those nonconformities were now conformities. And then just another real quick point that I would make is there's nothing in this legislation that changes the overall regulatory framework. It's the cities, the local units of government would still administer the actual rules just the same way that they administer the executive order now.
So, Mr. Hirsch, what we're doing here, you're saying the draft rules, we're dealing with some of these issues. If we extend the rulemaking process, we'll be able to get more hearing and testimony on those rules and then be able to adopt those rules where now we can't?
Mr. Hirsch.
And Mr. Chairman, we're unable to adopt the rules now because we, as Mr. Meyer said, we've lost our authority based on the provisions of Section 14.125. If you don't file a notice of intent to adopt the rule within 18 months of getting the authority, then you automatically lose your authority.
So, Mr. Hirsch, that these draft rules that you have, you'd be starting from those draft rules and then working to get those adopted and go having hearings and making sure you get public input, and so that these rules that you mentioned that were in the draft rules that would have helped Dayton and would have helped other cities along there could then be implemented, and that's what we're trying to do here, Mr. Hirsch?
Mr. Chairman, right. There's requirements in the Administrative Procedures Act for public input, but I think as Mr. Meyer stated, if we were to get our authority back, we would do some new outreach and public input outside of what's required in Chapter 14, just to get, because it's been a few years now, just to get all the cities familiar again with what was in there. There was, frankly, in the previous process, there was just a lot of misunderstanding about what was actually in those rules and what wasn't, and so I think that we would learn from some of those difficulties we had a few years ago and have some outreach processes, public input processes, to get everybody familiar with what's in there, get some input, see if there were some existing issues that we could make better, and then we'd still go through the required Chapter 14 process where there'd be additional public input.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Hirsch. Well, I'm glad that you feel that the city of Dayton, and then you've looked at it, and then you feel the city of Dayton's okay. I'm a little uncomfortable, too, because of the short notice and the lack of ability to get my city here to give me their version of this, and just not having the information I need in front of me. Representative Kahn, I'm wondering, has Representative Hortman or Representative Abler or Representative Uglum talk to you about this language at all and given you their thoughts on it?
Mr. Chairman, my emissary in all of this has been Representative Hansen, since he's much more informed about the subject than I am, and I believe he has reached out to most of those people.
Representative Hansen?
Specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pepin, I have not spoken with Representative Uglum or I have spoken with Representative Hortman. I'm going to be continuing to work with her on issues. She supports moving forward.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Hortman has issues. I'm guessing some of the other legislators will have some concerns on this, which just the process, the fast process, the late process, and then the fast process is a little concerning to me. I'm wondering, too, is this the language here? Is it the same exact language in the legacy bill, or is it different? Or if you could talk about that, Representative Kahn or Representative Hansen.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, the bill, the amendment that you have, and let me just back up. If you don't like House File 1775, I would really encourage support for the amendment, because the amendment, 1775 as it is, continues with the status quo and the statutes there. The A1 amendment has these changes to the bluffs and the redevelopment language that we had. I have worked, and I can have people from the St. Paul Port Authority and the City of St. Paul come up, and I know that they've also talked with the Chamber of Commerce, St. Paul Chamber of Commerce, on language. There are additional additional changes that are made in what was adopted in rules this morning that we could not get, and I've worked with the committee staff on. We were able to get the development and redevelopment because that was a simple oral amendment. The other line that was added specifically talks about taking into consideration commercial, residential, industrial, and recreational features. So it adds that in, I believe, as item number 15, and on it's in there twice. And that is the difference that I was able to achieve the proverbial peace in the valley with the St. Paul entities and on the language that was included in the Rules Committee. That happened after I had introduced the bill and worked with them and the amendment. So the language that it is different, but I think the language that we voted on this morning in rules, you will like better than A1 because it provides explicitly provides the commercial, residential, recreational, industrial features.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hansen. So is it the legacy language that's going forward? I'm confused now about, it's that's the language that's going forward?
Well, Representative Pepin, if this bill were to pass, get to the floor as a loan bill and pass, and it passed, I forget my rules here, right? If it passed after the legacy bill passed, this is the language that would be, that would go forward. If the legacy bill passes after this bill, if this bill went to the floor and passes an individual bill, then the legacy bill would language would take precedence.
So, Mr. Chair, what is the intention then? That doesn't really I don't have control over which comes first, but you perhaps have more control over that.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I believe when I give my word that it's I will keep my word and that I would put the language that I have agreed to that's in rules if this came second. I would do an amendment on the floor to make them the same because that's what I agreed to. And I want to be real clear, I'm not trying some maneuver here. I want to get the rules done. And I've tried over the last few days to make sure we can get this done and so there aren't the concerns. I think you're probably going to have some folks on both sides of the issue that may not be happy with it, but I think I've achieved some of the concern, ameliorating some of the concerns of St. Paul. And if this comes, if 1775 comes to the floor after the legacy bill, I will put in the language that is in the legacy bill rather than this. This, as you may be able to see, I've been working on this to try to get to a consensus, and we may not have a complete consensus, but I think we have a pretty good, and I would ask those entities to testify. So we got to the point where we were able to go beyond this. I couldn't get that amended here. We were able to do that in rules because we didn't have the 24-hour rule. So if this moves, I will amend it so that it's the same as what's in the legacy.
And Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hansen. And I haven't had a full chance to look at that language either. And so I guess I'd like to have the ability of my cities to be able to as well give feedback to you if they've got concerns. I'm glad that, you know, St. Paul and, there's peace in the valley there, but, you know, that it extends out a lot further than just St. Paul. And, I think that it's just important that we consider the whole state as we look at these issues. And so I think what I will do then is maybe touch base with my city again and touch base with Representative Hortman again and some of the other legislators and continue to work with you on legislation that also protects the cities we represent.
Representative Piskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch, the language in the original bill, maybe we're on the amendment, Mr. Chair. Should we wait till?
Well, we've been discussing both of them. It's
okay.
The amendment is more the bill. The bill just extends the rulemaking process, and this does the amendment does more. We haven't voted on the amendment yet, but
okay.
We're kind of discussing everything together here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Hirsch, I did hear, it's clear that statute only allows you to go 18 months after your authority is offered, and I get that. But the bill says to give you the rules that do not expire. Representative Kahn's nodding her head. Maybe she's got a response. But maybe it's already been asked, but why are we giving you rules that never expire?
Because
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative, as we discovered in the first iteration of this, that there really wasn't enough time. It was a very difficult issue. You had to bring in all of these communities in this area to do it, and we think it's better to do it right than to do it faster. I know the rules process never seems fast to anybody, but in this case, we clearly needed to, with the complications of doing this, we needed more time. So we're not going to put another extension in here. And that's why we meet in annual sessions. We can always come back and change this.
And Mr. Hirsch or Mr. Meyer, I guess along that same line, how long are we looking? Are we talking 2 years? Are we talking, because I see the same thing, and yeah. I understand we ran out of time last time because this is a complicated issue with many different points of view, and as Representative Pepin stressed here, I'm happy that St. Paul and those people have done that, but being from the Minneapolis side in Brooklyn Park and Representative Hortman, that sometimes the issues of Minneapolis and St. Paul don't always mesh equally. So, I mean, I understand Representative Pepin's. But what are we looking for a timeline? Because they're saying this the authority to create these rules doesn't expire. What are we looking for a timeline that we could see rules coming back and being promulgated?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the part of the difficulty in answering that is it depends on how much time we want to take with some of the initial outreach that Mr. Meyer spoke of earlier, which is outside of the Chapter 14 rulemaking process. And I would think for a rule like this, particularly with the amount of discussion it created the last time around, that we would want to spend some time on that. I mean, just the notification process alone to make sure that all the cities are notified, and then in turn, last time we were criticized because not all of the people or businesses that actually had property on the river were notified. So that takes a while. So I want to say that, we're going to want to spend probably 4 to 6 months just on the unofficial, if you will, outreach process. And then once we actually start the rulemaking process, in my experience, and this is one of the more complex rules, it can take over 2 years from start to finish. And to be clear, the 18-month requirement isn't the whole rule process. That's just from the time you get the authority to the time you publish the notice of intent to adopt. Once you publish the notice of intent to adopt, you still have quite a bit of process left. And so I'm going to say over 2 years once we actually start the official rulemaking process, and then add to that whatever amount of time we take for the unofficial outreach process.
And so, Mr. Hirsch, the intent here is to, with this, the rules not expire, is to give all these communities along the river in this stretch that we're talking about the ability to weigh in and express their concerns and make sure that when we promulgate these rules that maybe not people being happy with them, but they'll be able to live with them. Is that our intent here with this legislation? And Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. This is one of those rules where we really need to take the time to explain it and have a good process, and it's definitely going to take longer than 18 months because of that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch. So, Mr. Hirsch, you mentioned 2 years, and I know there's been some groundwork laid for the first 18 months. I assume most of that is usable in your process. So, I mean, if you doubled that and said 4 years, would you have it done in 4 years?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, I don't think I said it would take. I'm not sure I understand the question, I guess.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch, you said it would take at least 2 years or maybe 2.5. I couldn't quite understand.
Yep.
So if you had authority for 4 years from today or from this session, would you be rather certain you'd be able to fit the necessary time that you needed to finish these off properly with all of the interactions with the communities, et cetera, in that particular period of time?
Mr. Hirsch or Representative Kahn?
Well, what I'd like to say is that since we ran into problems with an expiration time, we'd rather not pick something which is kind of a random expiration time, even if it seems to make sense. As I said, we meet in annual sessions for a purpose. We can keep... There are a lot of people now interested in this than when it first passed. We can keep coming back and asking for progress and looking at it and seeing what we need to do. And the thought is not to put a date that any of us would pick, even if it might seem logical, but we don't want to have to go through this again. So, I think the point is to admit that the process was not sufficiently informative to bring people into it. It was not sufficiently deliberative. Where one of the things that came up is the need to that the rules, the law, was much too prescriptive, and so all of this has been part of the process, and we're trying to fix it so that, you know, I think any city, any community who objected to what was going on would be very pleased to see this direction.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I had a follow-up if I could. Oh.
Representative, quick follow-up. I cut Representative Hansen out before you when I called on you, too, so.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Khan, I mean, so the answer is just to give them the authority forever, which surprises me from you, but on rulemaking stuff.
Representative Khan.
Mr. Chairman, as Representative Hansen said, that the people on all sides of this may not be happy in different directions. I understand the concerns that have been raised, and whereas in some places would like to see the river kept as natural as possible, maybe even in Dayton. In other places, I understand that, you know, we need, in order to have a working river, in order to have a river that encompasses all kinds of tourism and activity along it, which might not be as consistent with a total naturalistic treatment of the river, we may need to make changes, and I want the process to go forward in a deliberative way, bringing everybody together till they are in agreement. Are in agreement with that they can live with what results.
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Khan, I understand that forever would allow for multiple rulemaking processes forever beyond this one. So obviously, the intent inherently in making it forever, at least the way I see it, is to give them the authority to get engaged in rules beyond this particular process, which I don't know what they need that for, but I struggle with giving an agency this type of authority.
Well,
thank you.
Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I don't want them to go on forever. I don't want the committee to go on forever. I'd like to get the rules done, and I think that we can continue that discussion about whether it's reporting back. As I've mentioned, we have been unable to do some of the amendments because of the time rule, and this... I want to get the rules done, and I think, again, on the amendment, if you don't like 1775, you should like the amendment, because the amendment clarifies some of those provisions, and I would ask if we could move forward on the amendment.
And Representative Driscoll.
I like how things kind of circle back, because my questions were on the amendment.
Yeah.
And specifically through Representative Hansen, I might be able to provide some clarification on this. And are you referring to the amendment from rules today, Amendment 60, A60 amendment?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, yes.
Can you just, for the committee's benefit, share if there were any amendments to that amendment?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, there weren't any in the rules. We passed it as it was. I do know that Representative Khan had added some provisions that related to other sections of that bill that were not specific to this issue, but they were in the draft of the amendment as technical corrections. That answers.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Representative Hansen, because I do have a copy of that amendment. It may be helpful for Representative Pepin and others to just review that language. And I think you did a nice job of dealing with the oral amendment, and you were right from what's in the A60 amendment. Line 15 adds commercial, industrial, and residential resources, and then on page 2 to that amendment, it adds a fifth provision under subdivision 3 districts. Management of river corridors consistent with natural characteristics and its existing development, and in consideration of potential new commercial, industrial, and residential development. Is that how you... Yeah, okay, and I see that Representative Pepin probably had to step to another committee, but I'll get this to her if that's the language. That might be helpful to her and others on our side who have questions with that.
And I think Representative Hansen's on that same committee. I don't know if you need to go for a vote or...
Oh, Mr. Chair.
But If no further questions on the amendment, why don't we adopt the amendment to put it in the bill in the order the author wants. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
And A1 amendment as amended. All opposed? The motion's approved. The amendment's adopted. Now to the bill as a whole. Any more questions on the bill? Anybody else in the audience that needs to speak to or for or against the bill? I see Mr. Johnson moving on down to the...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'll start us off. I very much want to thank Representative Kahn and Representative Hansen for the work they've done on this to address some of our concerns. We were very involved in this, and it was very contentious the first time when Representative Hansen put the legislation together and during the rule process that followed that, which is the reason that it didn't get completed in the timeline suggested. If the rules are going to move forward, we do support that the language that was adopted in the Rules Committee this morning be the language that's attached to that. I would add that in the Senate side, when we worked on this, we did add a report back to the legislature after 2 years on the progress of the rules to the committees with jurisdiction over the environment. So that language, during the process, I expect we can bring that up and have that included because it does exist in the Senate language right now. We felt that was just a good check-in, is that if they haven't completed the work in 2 years, they should at least be telling the legislature why not. Mr. Chair, with that, all I can say is this is a pretty important issue to our cities. We have a number of them that are very concerned about how it can affect them. We also have a number that are sitting with restrictions on what they can do in their cities based on a decision made in 1979. And the land uses in their communities have changed drastically since then, and they are not able to develop them because at that time they were agricultural and they're required to stay that way. And so there's a number of cities that are very anxious for these rules to be completed, and some townships in the southern part of the reaches as this river goes through the Twin Cities that are very hopeful that this could actually allow them to do some additional things to develop along the river that they currently can't do. So I think it's going to be a very mixed bag. You're going to have people that are affected in both directions. But I do think that the change to back us up a little and remove the prescriptive definitions that were in statute is really going to make this a much more workable process for our cities as they participate in the rule writing.
Any questions of the testifiers? If not, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Anybody else who needs to speak for or against the bill? Any further questions on the bill? Representative Pepman.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to roll call this.
Roll call being requested.
And
Representative Pepman.
Mr. Chair, I still have a lot of questions about this, and because of my city and their concerns, I want to be on the record as opposing the legislation at this time. Perhaps it might change, and then just some concerns on that, wanting to learn more about the rulemaking. So,
and I think you were out of the room when Representative Duskowski asked about the rules not expiring, but I share some of your concerns because my city also is along that river just south of Dayton, and Representative Hortman has raised issues, and I think listening to the testimony, the allowing these rules to go forward and having the public input in the rulemaking process, I think we can get to a solution that serves the area as a whole. Like Mr. Johnson said, Dayton is probably in that point where they were in 79, they were mostly agricultural, and under the current rules, they can't change that, is my understanding. And the rulemaking process might be able to get to where Dayton can do the development they want to do and need to do to prosper as a city. So, but I duly noted that your objection. I know the roll will be called.
Yeah.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
The other thing, of course, with these not ability to amend on the fly, I will certainly follow the suggestion which was started by Mr. Representative Draskowski, and I will do a report back to the legislature on the process of what's
and
happening.
Representative Kahn, I assume if it's in the Senate language, when it gets to conference, that there'll be different. Sure. So,
but if people feel happy, we do have
ability.
We do have the ability to do that amendment into the before the legacy bill is taken up on the House floor. So we have the ability to do that. If that, it's not a question of making people happy. It's just actually good process.
Thank you, Madam Representative Kahn. Any further questions? If not, the clerk will take. I'll Representative Kahn renews her motion that House File 1775, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Rules. The clerk will take the roll.
Nelson?
Yes.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Dorholt?
Yes.
Piskowski?
No.
Volk?
Yes.
Hansen?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Ween?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pugh?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Tice?
No.
Winkler?
Yes.
Vote being 8 ayes and 6 nays, the motion is approved. The bill is passed.
Thank you very much.
And the next bill on the agenda is House File 1765. And I'll hand the chair over to...
Welcome to the table, Chair Nelson, if you could.
And I'll move House File 1765 be recommended to pass and move to Commerce. And members, I have an amendment, the DE1 amendment is my amendment. It basically goes at some issues that came up in Labor Committee. That tightening back up with some of the in the bill, there's a, on line 1.12, there's a reference to the North American industry classification, and that was a little broader than we wanted it to be, so I moved the DE1 amendment.
Chair Nelson moves the DE1 amendment. Are there any questions to the amendment? Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When was the DE1 amendment posted for members of the public to see?
Chair Nelson.
Mr. Gelvin, I believe, posted.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that was posted at about 11 o'clock yesterday morning.
Yeah, the timestamp does say yesterday, 10:03, is when this was prepared. Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just want to note for the record that not only in this bill missed deadline by a lot, and wasn't introduced until 4:11. Now the DE1 amendment was introduced, delete everything amendment was introduced on April 16th and had a day for people to come and testify. So I just wanted to point that out to...
Sure. Duly noted, it should be mentioned that this did meet the committee's 24-hour rule. Any further questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape the chair would like, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment passes. There is the second amendment also, is one of the other amendments yours? Okay. So if you'd like to proceed just describing the bill.
I'll describe my bill. And members, the purpose of the House File 1765 is to require labor peace agreements between infrastructure project developers and the unions that represent workers in the hospitality industry when taxpayer funds are put at risk of the project project financing. The concept of labor peace agreements is not new to the state or to the legislature. In the past, when the state has made investment in private development that involves the creation of server jobs, hotel worker jobs, the state has made sure that there will not be economic disruption to the project constructions. It is done this by ensuring that a labor peace agreement is in place as part of the development before going forward with the public subsidy. Labor peace agreements are essentially a contract between the project developer or manager and the hospitality industry. The agreement lays out an orderly process by which workers can learn about labor unions and choose whether or not they wish to join. Again, it's a process where they can learn about them and choose whether or not they wish to join. The agreement prevents the union from staging pickets or economic boycotts that could disrupt the construction or economic or operation of the development. In return, the management remains neutral in the conversation between union members and workers. Unions are currently within their right to picket or boycott projects as a means of forcing management to recognize the workers may wish to join a union. However, when we invest taxpayer dollars, we have to be certain that economic disruptions do not put taxpayer dollars at risk. This is why labor peace agreements have been and should be required as part of publicly financed hospitality infrastructure projects. The labor peace agreements are commonplace in the hospitality industry, and there's a handout in your packet that lists a bunch of them. And every major hotel chain throughout the country and cities throughout the country have signed agreements with the Unite Here union to work in place to put in place an orderly process for the workers to learn about and decide whether they wish to join the union. In Minnesota, the Unite Here unions have signed agreements with the Twins, the Minnesota Vikings, the City of St. Paul, the XL Arena, St. Paul Saints, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and the numerous hotel projects, including the new Radisson Blue that will open shortly at the Mall of America. Also, when the Republican National Convention came to town in 2008, the RNC signed a general short-term labor peace agreement with the local labor to avoid labor strife and pickets at their events. There were no labor pickets or labor disruption at any of the events held in the facilities throughout the metro area. Public bodies across the country, including the state of Minnesota, have found that these agreements are useful to ensure that plans for development and construction go forward in an orderly fashion. Also, the city of Minneapolis presently has a labor peace ordinance on their books. Minneapolis refuses to invest in hotel projects unless there is an agreement between the union and the developer. The state of New York, Miami-Dade County, Prince George's County, Cook County, and cities of Pittsburgh, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Miami, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C. have labor peace agreements on their books. We believe the state of Maryland is currently considering legislation this year. In those instances where the developers of the projects with state or local funding have declined to have an agreement, state or local entities have added labor peace language as a condition of public subsidy. In 2008, as part of the round of Mall America public subsidy, the legislature included a labor peace requirement that facilitated the agreement on the Radisson Blue property. For those members who voted for the 2008 tax bill, you have already voted for a labor peace agreement, and Governor Pawlenty at the time signed it. Without a labor peace agreement in place, once construction is finished and the hotel is up and running, the state's proprietary interest and the public investment could be compromised. There could be a labor dispute on the site, and the operator can prevent labor workers from learning about the union, including restricting access and communication, despite millions of dollars of public subsidies and taxpayer dollars being spent on the site. Management can intimidate or fire workers who ask for union membership to ensure fair wages and better working conditions or health benefits. While this is not the primary goal of this legislation, certainly it is a desirable outcome that workers at sites with public investment have jobs with fair working conditions and fair pay for the work they do. While server jobs may look easy, the work required by these people in these jobs is often physically demanding. For example, women in hotel housekeeping jobs experience a very high rate of worker injury. So Unite Here works with both the employers and employees to ensure that the workplace standards are met and pay is commensurate with the work that is done. In closing, while in the past the legislature has required labor peace as part of individual project, it is smarter to have a law in the books that sets that expectation of protecting taxpayers' interests. Rather than reacting to projects, let's be proactive and set a reasonable requirement by putting labor peace into law. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll take questions.
Questions for Chair Nelson? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, can you walk through the bill and tell us what the bill says?
Chair Nelson.
What the bill says is that when we put money, public subsidies, into the project, that the qualifying projects that are part of that,
that before construction can begin, the managers or the owners of the project that's going to get built, that they negotiate and talk to and sign a labor peace agreement with the hotel workers that might be working in there in the future. And it just basically says, we'll allow you to come and talk to our workers if you, the union, gives up your agree or tells us that you're not going to disrupt the construction of this project. And so the union is giving up their right to do what they're legally guaranteed to do under National Labor Relations Act in exchange for being able to talk to the workers once the project is built and those workers are hired.
Representative Juskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, what type of talking to the workers are you talking about?
Chair Nelson.
Representative Juskowski, Mr. Chair, it's with the normal organizing process that they go on. They talk to the workers, sort of like as a friend of mine who was a business agent with me, talked about he used to be a member of the Jehovah's Witnesses, and it was sort of like going out and prophesizing to those people about the benefits of being in a union. And that's what he looked at. Our job is talking to the non-union or unorganized workers. And that's what these people do. And they go out and tell them, talk to them and tell them what the benefits would be and why they would be to their benefit to join the union. And that's what they'd be talking to them about.
Representative Juskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when they do their...
prophesize.
However you say that, Representative Nelson, prophesizing. To the workers, does that include coming forward with a card upon which they would indicate their preference for a union certifying election?
Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Juskowski, that would be follow the normal National Labor Relations Act model that goes forward, and yes, that would involve getting authorization card signed, getting to a threshold to get to an election, getting to an election, and then moving forward from there. And if the election failed, the project would not be, and the union would have to walk away for at least a year. And that's how the process works. That's the normal process that we have in current National Labor Relations law.
Representative Juskowski.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, so is it USC 29, Section 185 that outlines all of that? I haven't dug into there, but I'm assuming, Representative Nelson, what you're saying is that there is where we go to find out what all the activities are that are authorized by the union. And then the related question is what type of elements do we see in a labor peace agreement? Is that prescribed there as well?
Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Juskowski, I will let phone a friend here answer that question. He's a high-paid attorney, so he can answer that better than I can. He's just a lowly carpenter. But no, that part of the law is not that part. That this deals with the other specific things, and Mr. Cummings can describe that.
Also, if you could please identify yourself for the tape, Mr. High-Priced Attorney.
Brendan Cummins, not a high-priced attorney, union attorney. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 29 U.S.C. Section 185, which is the statutory site, does not prescribe particular content of a labor peace agreement. What it does is a body of case law interpreting and applying that provision that determines when a contract between an employer and a labor organization is valid. And that would include when a labor peace agreement is valid. And there's standards of federal labor law for making that determination. As far as the content of a labor peace agreement, under this bill, there's two requirements, and only two. And that is no work stoppages, no economic interference of any kind by the labor organization with the employer of hospitality workers with their operations, with their hospitality operations. The other is binding arbitration as a means of peacefully and efficiently resolving any labor disputes without work stoppages. So this is really limited to labor peace. Preventing potentially costly and disruptive labor disputes from undermining the public investment in a development project. Labor peace agreements can contain other provisions and frequently do, but the state's interest here is not in doing that, is not in prescribing what the content of the agreement is going to be, other than the state's limited interest in preventing labor disruption from threatening the public's investment in a development project.
Representative Juskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, so two requirements are no work stoppage and has to include binding arbitration. I do see where it talks about work stoppages, boycotts, etc. I'm curious, have we had any, I'm curious what the motivation is for the bill to begin with. I don't know that we've had people picketing government projects or government finance projects. I mean, we, Lord knows we do enough of those. So I'm curious where the
sure.
motivation for this comes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, one of the reasons we haven't seen as much disruption of these major projects is because of the prevalence of labor peace agreements in first-class cities, which this would reinforce and expand. For example, the city of Minneapolis has a labor peace ordinance that applies to hotel developments, has a labor peace resolution. I was involved in drafting these, and they're very similar to the requirements here. And so we have instances in major cities. The city of Duluth, which is another one of the first-class cities in Minnesota, which would be covered. They've got a labor peace ordinance in the hospitality industry as well. So one of the reasons you don't see it so frequently is they're already on the books in some instances labor peace requirements. Having said that, what this bill would do is more of a good thing. There's a reason why those laws are on the books, and it's to prevent disruption to major public investments that affect the hospitality industry, which is vital for the local economy, for interstate commerce, for development in these particular cities. So this is more of a good thing in protecting labor peace.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, so you mentioned two of the cities of the first class. We have Minneapolis and Duluth. Does St. Paul or Rochester, do they have labor peace agreements?
St. Paul... Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, St. Paul has used labor peace agreements on particular projects. They do not, to my knowledge, have an across-the-board resolution or ordinance in the hospitality industry. It's been more on a project-specific basis.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, how about Rochester?
Mr. Cummins.
I'm not aware of anything in Rochester, personally. I've worked on these labor peace provisions in Duluth, St. Paul, and Minneapolis. I just haven't been down to Rochester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, you mentioned hospitality workers and hospitality projects. Is this limited to review again, is this only during construction of these hospitality type projects? I see food and beverage operations, sports facility, convention center, civic center, cultural venue with catering, cafeteria facilities, hotel, etc. Is it projects that eventually yield a hospitality venue that this bill calls for, or does it roll over to that particular establishment in its operation beyond the point at which the construction's done?
Chair Nelson.
This would run for the length of the time that the state is, or the state or the city or the county is giving them either through TIF dollars, some sort of subsidy. Once the subsidy's out, they would no longer be bound by the labor peace agreement.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Nelson, so if a local city, and by the way, there's a lot of construction projects that happen around the state that don't have labor peace ordinances. Apparently, two of our first-class cities do, two don't, and the entire rest of the state does not. And still, I have not heard of any interruption of projects like this. So again, I wonder about the need for this. It doesn't seem to be necessary, but I'm wondering, I just wonder about the need for it. I lost my train of thought prior to that. I'll yield for now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Sure. Representative O'Driscoll was on the list, but he stepped out. Are there additional questions? And I'll come back to him when he comes back in. Oh. Representative O'Driscoll, you were next on the list. Would you like to speak now or get a moment to find your place.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It wasn't my intent to make a grand re-entrance when my name came up. But I do have some questions if the author or others to his liking could answer. The DE amendment, line 1.8 says, state and local governments has a proprietary interest or act as market participants, and then it begins to list a number of things, in whole or in part, provides grant, providing loans, contributing real estate. I'm going to stop right there and ask for what a definition of contributing real estate is to a particular project as relates to this bill.
Chair Nelson?
Mr.
Cummins?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, contributing real property would mean transferring real property for purposes of the development of the project. So transferring ownership of the property.
Chair O'Driscoll.
If there was a market, a fee appraisal done on this and the developer paid fair market value for that property and purchasing it from the city, would that still be considered contributing to the project?
Mr. Cummins?
If it was a sale, if it was a sale of property, would it be a contribution of property? My understanding of the intent, and I'm not the author, but my understanding of the intent of this is that it would be if there is an investment being done by the public. And just a sale at fair market value may not be that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Chair Nelson?
I think this is more aimed at if a city comes in, clears a property, cleans up a brownfield, and then hands the property over for the value of a dollar to a developer to build on. I think that's what we're getting at. I think if it's a fair sale value, it would not be fall into that. If the city bought the property, cleaned it up, and then sold it at the market value, I don't think that would fall into that range.
Representative Mr. Chair, Driscoll?
Thank you. How about contributing some interest in that real estate, like an easement?
Mr. Cummins or Chair Nelson?
Representative Driscoll, I don't believe, and again, that depends on what the easement is and what it involves. I mean, I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, that's why I'm asking the questions, because it's pretty vague in here, too, as to what the definitions are for these. Personal property infrastructure. Typically, projects may need to have infrastructure such as road improvements that might be a public expense that would not only benefit that property but others. Sewer and water projects, upgrades, would those be considered contributing to if they were assessed back under 429 here in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, I believe so, yes. In that case, they would be.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if a city has a requirement that you must be hooked up to city sewer and water, and some of that's even dictated by state statute, we kind of have folks hooked in on here because they have to have that. But yet, since it's going to be assessed back and they're going to be paying fair market value under 429 for that, there would be the requirement of a peace agreement on here, if I'm understanding that correctly.
Chair Nelson?
I guess Representative O'Driscoll, Mr. Chair, are we talking about if there's an existing sewer there? Or are we talking about if they take a piece of bare land and develop streets, and the city develops streets and sewer lines and water lines specifically for this project? Or are we talking just hooking up to an existing sewer and water? I guess if you were just hooking up to existing sewer and water, I don't think that would be any more than what would be assessed as a cost from the city already. I don't think that would qualify. But if they're extending lines out solely for a project, that might fall into that public subsidy.
Representative Winkler, did you have something to this point?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I'd just like to add that if, to the extent this is infrastructure or other real estate contributions in which the state does, in the ordinary course of its activity as a state enterprise or as a state entity, it would tend to not fit the definition of a market participant. This is when the state is providing value, some sort of subsidy from the taxpayer to the benefit of a project and hopes to recapture some of that value in some other way. That's when the state is acting as a market participant that permits these type of labor peace agreements. If the state is just creating a general infrastructure and saying that somebody builds a puts up a building on a piece of land next to a street that the city is putting in, that is not a specific state contribution to the particular project that would allow a labor peace agreement to be required under the NLRB. So there are limits on what could trigger a labor peace agreement that are set out in the preemption doctrine related to the National Labor Relations Act. So there are limits in the definition, basically, of that are part of the case law interpreting these kinds of peace agreements.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate Representative Winkler's providing some clarification, but there was no terminology or definitions as to what market participant meant for this particular statute. It's used in language here, but it's not defined specifically as to what that is. If I might move on, Mr. Chair, to a couple of other questions that I have.
Second, Representative Pepin, do you have something to this point, or did you just want to be put on? Okay. Mr. Cummins, did you want to respond to this point?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could speak to that point about market participant or proprietary interest. My understanding is that language was included in this bill because it is they're terms of art in federal labor law, and there's a body of case law interpreting what they mean, and the these different terms are supposed to be or should be construed in light of proprietary interest or market participant. And to define what proprietary interest or market participant is quite a difficult task to do in 10 words or less, but there is a body of case law that construes it. And in each particular instance where public financing is being issued, a determination can be made in light of that case law as to whether a proprietary interest is in play or is at risk.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Again, it doesn't in this section specify that. That's why I'm asking the questions, because we have some terms that can mean different things to different people. But if I could move on to Section 2 here. Qualifying project means a project that is located in a county that contains a city of the first class as defined in 410.01. And basically, as I think Representative Draskowski brought forward, there's really only three cities right now that meet that definition: Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. But at many other points in the statute, we have the city of Duluth wanting to be included as a, where it says cities of the first class and Duluth, and cities of the first class and Duluth. And it doesn't specifically state that in here. However, I did understand that Duluth has voluntarily participated in, if I understand the testimony correctly, has voluntarily participated in labor peace agreements. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Shepherd can correct me on this if I say it incorrectly, Duluth is still considered a city of the first class that they're grandfathered in, and so it's the cities of the first class would be Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. So we're talking St. Louis, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Olmsted County.
Well, Mr. Chair, oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, because I had that very same question, and it says as defined by 410.01, which says cities of the first class are defined as, and it does not mention or reference Duluth, and it goes on to cities of the second class and cities of the third class. So that's why I raised the question, because we have a reference in here to a city that clearly doesn't define Duluth by population at this point. So that was one of the questions that I had.
Mr. Shepherd, did you have a clarifying point on that?
Mr. Chair, I'll look at the volume of laws and then comment later.
Okay, sure. That'd be fine. Representative O'Driscoll, did you have additional questions?
Yeah, just a couple of questions additional right now. I guess I'm going to just skip a few of the other items here, because I do have a number of questions, but one that really I think needs to have some discussion by the committee and clarification is under hospitality workers. We talk about casino hotels. To the best of my knowledge, right now under Minnesota law and where we've been at in the last number of sessions, there are no publicly owned or privately owned unless they're on a sovereign nation, and I'm wondering how the state of Minnesota would be able to direct a sovereign nation that might have these casino hotels to abide by this provision.
Chair Nelson or Mr. Cummins?
I believe that's in, I'm trying to find it here because I know I believe that's in there twice. And I think it was, as I read through this, I think that was put in by mistake, because I think you're right. There are none unless they're on tribal casinos, and my understanding, if they were on tribal land, this law would not be effective anyway. So if it would give the Representative O'Driscoll comfort, we can take that language out. And where are we looking at here?
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
There may be multiple references in here, but the one that caught my eye was on line 120, hotels, and then the next two words are casino hotels.
Just a moment here. Maybe another.
And Mr. Chair, if Representative Driscoll wishes, we can take that language out. I'd be amenable to that. He wants to make that as a motion, as an amendment.
Okay. I guess Representative O'Driscoll, did you want to make an oral amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I certainly don't want to have us go forward with a law that would, with legislation, that would violate law.
Sure.
So I would be open to offering that oral amendment for, as it applies here, to delete casino hotels from this bill and any other references. And again, I haven't had a chance to study each line in here because there is an awful lot of terminology in here, and as you kind of start to digest it, so I would offer that as an oral amendment.
Okay. Yeah, we've only spotted the one. I think as this moves forward, you know, this I'm sure could be, if there is something else along those lines that could be addressed, and this does seem like a minor amendment along the lines of what we discussed before. So are there any further comments on that amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'd accept that as a friendly amendment.
Sure. Okay. Chair accepts it as friendly. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The amendment is adopted. Representative.
And Mr. Chair, I don't want to dominate the committee's time with this, and I certainly would defer to other members if they have some questions. But before I do that, I was just wondering if maybe Mr. Shepherd could, if he's had time to kind of review the City of the First Class issue before we move on.
Sure. Representative Driscoll, did you have anything to this point, or just added to the list after Representative Pepin? Okay. Sure. Mr. Shepherd, did you...
Mr. Chair and members, the definition of a city of the first class says that it includes those that have 100,000 or more inhabitants, but it says that, as Representative Nelson indicated, once a city is defined to be of the first class, it is not reclassified until its population decreases by 25% from the census figures which last qualified the city for inclusion in the class. So if the population of Duluth were 100,000 when it was last included as a city of the first class, it would continue to be that as long as its population was more than 75,000.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll?
Not to play Trivial Pursuit with the committee, but do we know what the 2010 census was? Or is that based on annual numbers? Do we know what the 2010 census was? Or is that based on annual numbers done by the state demographer?
I'm pretty sure Duluth has not gone below 75,000. I certainly don't know what it is, but I want to say it's in the 90,000 range, but I don't know if anyone...
My recollections are closer to 80, but
oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, I won't belabor that point, no pun intended, but I will just offer this. Does that automatically then preclude them from an agreement of this source if they were to fall below 75,000?
Chair Nelson or Mr. Cummins?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, no, wouldn't preclude them from doing it on their own if they drop below the 75.
Staff, Chair, Representative O'Driscoll?
To the scope of this bill, they would not be required. They could certainly do something at the local level.
Chair Nelson.
Representative O'Driscoll, Mr. Chair, yes, if they fell out of that and fell to 75, they could do it on their own if they wanted to.
Also, Representative O'Driscoll, staff who is quicker with Google searches than I am informed me that the population of Duluth at the 2010 census was 86,265 people.
So right in the middle.
Yeah, pretty much. I wasn't gonna say it. Representative Pepin, or I'm sorry, Representative O'Driscoll, is that?
And again, I don't know. I thank Bryn for that. She is good with coming up with that information. The other question is, and this is a legitimate question from the standpoint of, is that based on census or is it based on the demographer's annual estimates of populations for communities? because that can change. And coming from a community that's growing rapidly, yeah, that has been an issue for us on an ongoing basis.
Mr. Shepherd, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair and members, there's a reference at the end of the section that's referenced here that references changes in classification from a future national census, and that it takes effect upon filing of certified copies of the census in the office of the Secretary of State. I don't know if there's something else. Ms. Dyson's not here anymore, and I could check with her, or I'll ask Mr. Johnson from the League of Cities if he knows. He doesn't know more, but
Mr. Chair,
Representative O'Driscoll.
I think we are tied to 410.01 because that's what the bill ties us to as definition on this. So I think Mr. Shepherd has answered my questions. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. I'm just trying to understand this whole thing. I mean, looking at the section, including section 2.13 to 2.16. Basically, the gist of it is if there's any public financing at all, the labor unions will control whether or not the project goes forward, and that's on all contracts and subcontracts. Is that kind of the gist of the idea?
Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, no, that's not the gist of the argument. But this is traditionally when we've done projects like this, including the Viking Stadium, including the Gopher Stadium, including the Twin Stadium, projects at the Mall of America, the Hotel Blue is one that we mentioned earlier. When we've done these projects, we've required project labor agreements for the construction of them. This is to allow the workers that are going to be working in these buildings after they're built, while they're still getting the subsidy, the ability to, and basically it's that so that their tax dollars, because they're tax-paying Minnesota citizens that are working there, aren't used against them, that they have the ability to at least decide for themselves whether they want to be union or not. And it allows the hospitality union to be able to talk to them and without interference from management. And that's what this is about. And because these people, they're tax-paying citizens of the state of Minnesota, that they should have their tax dollars used against them.
Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. I think it's a little heavier-handed than that by reading the language. The labor peace agreement definition in itself means a valid collective bargaining agreement or other contract between an employer of hospitality workers and any labor organization seeking to represent hospitality workers on a qualifying project. And then the qualifying project goes forward during the entire financing, so it could be many, many, many years on that. And I'm not even really clear how that works. I'm looking at line 2.19 through 2.21. Again, where it talks about any employer of hospitality worker, blah, 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 must have a labor peace agreement with any interested labor organization prior to and as a condition precedent of state or local government financing. So that tells me if there's any hint of financing, then really they're held at the mercy of labor unions. I'm wondering specifically how the process works, any interested labor organization. So how do they know when any interested organization, labor organization, might be done being interested? Is there a timeline? Is there, I mean, I don't know how many labor organizations are out there. Do they have to contact every potential labor organization to see if they're interested in speaking with employees? Just kind of walk me through how exactly that works. How do they know when the process of any interested organization? And then too, if you could fill me in on what are the potential unions? What size is the list? Who exactly are they?
Chair Nelson or Mr. Cummins?
Yeah. I'll let Mr. Cummins answer that. He's probably got to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, there's really only one union in Minnesota that represents hospitality workers, and that's Unite Here, Local 17. If a state law said you must have a contract with this union and only this union, there would be a problem under the federal labor laws of favoring one union over others. Workers could choose at some point to form another hospitality workers union. Right now, there really is only one union I'm aware of that focuses on that in Minnesota, but workers certainly have the right to form another union that would compete. And if that were the case, then this would apply to them as well. As far as how the process works, If the union, if there is a union interested in representing or already represents the workers of the hospitality employer, then a labor peace agreement has to be in place as a condition of the public financing. And that doesn't mean, the financing doesn't happen unless the union says so. It means that the union has to give up the right to strike and disrupt the project. That's really the key here. The union must give up its right to disrupt the project, and the parties both must agree to submit disputes to binding arbitration. That's what this is about, is protecting the state's interest in its return on investment, or the government, the local government's interest in its return on investment. So the process works by a union expressing the interest and then the parties negotiating an agreement that has to have those minimum protections for the public investment as a condition of the investment.
Representative Bevin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins. So in order to protect the state investment, a labor union has to do all of the work, including all the subcontracting, or somehow the state isn't being protected on their investment? Is that, did I hear you right on that?
Mr. Cummins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the labor union has to agree to give up its right to disrupt the work. That's what it has to do. There is no obligation to get the work done union, no obligation of that type at all. This just regarding giving up the right to strike and having a peaceful, streamlined process for resolving disputes. Now, the typical scenario with a labor peace agreement is, as the chair has described it, a recognition process by which workers choose whether they want a union or not. It's an organizing or recognition process where there's neutrality in place. The employer agrees not to take a position one way or the other on unionization. It's a process, a recognition process agreement. That's a common type of labor peace agreement. There's no obligation the job be done union or the hospitality workers be union. The obligation is that the union, in attempting to organize, can't disrupt the work, and that's what the state's interest is.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Cummins. I'm not sure I agree so much with your definitions, and especially about who exactly this is protecting. I know at least one think tank said that that labor peace agreements can increase the cost of publicly funded projects by 12% to 18%, and I can see why they would. And I don't know how increasing the cost of a project protects the public. If it might protect the particular workers involved, and that's maybe a good thing, probably is a good thing, but I don't know that you can make the statement that it's protecting the public investment because it's driving up the cost. So do you think that study that it's the Cato Institute that made that estimate, do you think that number is wrong? Do you think that the state saves money by having these types of agreements in place?
Mr. Cummins.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, the Cato Institute is obviously coming from a very particular libertarian perspective that is not favorable to unions. It's not exactly an academic, unbiased think tank, is one comment I would make. But beyond that, the purpose of the labor peace agreement is to protect the interest in the development, that the state's interest, as long as it has an interest, as long as it's financing the project, against disruption of the project that could affect the return on investment. That's the role that labor peace plays. Judgments have been made by major cities, in particular Minneapolis, has two different labor peace requirements, that this is good public policy that protects the government's interest. In Minnesota, it is a common thing. It's been done frequently, and it works. I'm not aware of that study. I'll take a look at it just for my own curiosity. I've been doing labor peace for a long time, but I'm not familiar with it, and I would take it with a grain of salt.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cummins. How would these agreements work with projects? And maybe you might not be familiar with this, so I'll ask Representative Nelson. How would this work with a kind of a joint public-private project, like if the Mayo, for what it's called, Destination Medical Center project, were passed. So it would have some public financing, but certainly also a great private sector aspect as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, as we heard the Rochester Destination Medical Center bill that came through here, and I know it's changed a little bit since then, but as from my recollection of what we heard it here, my understanding of what the bill is, the private investment, Mayo buildings on their own, and that's what the bill was about, was Mayo was going to invest this much money into that, their facility, but they were asking the city of Rochester to do some infrastructure work, do some TIF work to build buildings around them, and hotels was part of that. The Mayo part of the building, this private investment, totally private investment, this would not cover. If there are hotels or there are other structures that are built that do have public subsidy, they would be required to sign a labor peace agreement. If there's a hotel that's built in Rochester as part of that project that takes no subsidy, again, that would be private investment and would not require a labor peace agreement unless they wanted to sign it on their own. And so that's, so I think there's, we're parsing out three different pieces of this, but it's the Duluth part, the Rochester legislation, as I remember it and as I understand it, Rochester, the Mayo Clinic is going to be investing money in their facility and maybe extending their facility. They're asking the city of Rochester to say, if we do this investment, you're going to come back afterwards and help us get the rest of the city built out so that we can have the infrastructure we need for our facility to function properly and to be that destination medical center.
It's my understanding that proposal has and will probably go through more substantial changes as well since we lessening the state contribution, most likely, since we heard it in this committee. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's going to be in the ice cold tax bill. I think that's the opposite of Representative David's smoking hot tax bill. So we'll see how that goes. Which states have these? I understand that there's a number of states. I actually heard the word prohibit. I don't know if that's faulty information, if they just don't have it, or if there are states that actually prohibit.
Chair Nelson or Mr. Cummins?
As I read in my testimony, the state of New York has it. Cities of Pittsburgh, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Miami, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Cook County, Prince George's County, and Miami-Dade County in Florida have these. And also the state of Maryland is currently considering doing this.
Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I believe there are, well, it looks like even on your graph, there's a number of states that don't have it. Is that just because they don't have it, or do they actually prohibit labor peace agreements? More specifically,
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I don't know if there are any that prohibit it. It's just that those ones don't have them currently. And Mr. Cummins, I see is raising his hand. Maybe he can answer.
Mr. Cummins,
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, it would be illegal to prohibit labor peace agreements because they are protected and lawful and enforceable agreements between employers and labor organizations under federal labor law. So a state couldn't outlaw them. A state could choose not to use them, you know, in its own interests, but they can't say to private parties you can't have them. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I think I just have one final question. Is this model legislation from any organization?
Mr. Cummins or Chair Nelson?
Not that I'm aware of. It was there's language that the city ordinance that Minneapolis have. I don't know what this was exactly. I mean, if Mr. Cummins can answer that question.
Could, Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. My understanding is this language is modeled after the city of Pittsburgh ordinance that was upheld by the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Judge Michael Chertoff, who's not exactly a flaming liberal, authored the opinion. Upholding the legislation is very well considered, well crafted decision, upholding this type of language, this type of requirement, and it was in the hospitality industry, and in particular involved the case on point involved tax increment financing. It's called the Sage Hospitality case. So this type of language has been upheld, and it is, I'll tell you, a model around the country because of that case.
Representative Pepin?
Thank you. Do you know if it's a model of the organization Progressive States Network? Is it model legislation of that organization?
I
know how Representative Winkler feels about model legislation, so I'm just curious.
I don't know.
Mr. Cummins.
I've never heard of that organization. I know that unions frequently cite this and try to propose language modeled after this because it's been upheld. And I recommend it because it's been upheld. But I have never heard of this Progressive States thing.
Representative Pepin?
That's all I have for now.
Okay. The only other question I have on the list is Representative Druskowski. I'm happy to come back to him when and if he returns to the room. I do have an A3 amendment here. Representative Winkler, is that?
Mr. Chair, the A3 amendment is my amendment. I was going to offer it and withdraw it, but I don't even think there's really a point to offering it. I can just talk about the idea. The amendment would add a third requirement for labor peace agreements besides arbitration and the prohibition on disruption. This would add a third requirement, which is that the rates of pay for the workers in the hotels and restaurants covered would actually have to be equal to or greater than the basic needs cost of living amount. If you might remember, this was an issue that was raised in the jobs bill the other night that was passed. The deed is going to start to calculate this. There are organizations currently calculating, and right now, just to meet a bare-bones basic budget, if you have a family of four, two individuals working, statewide average is that each of those individuals has to make $14 an hour just to pay for food, clothing, shelter, transportation. As I said, family of four, child, so that would include child care, health care, to meet basic needs. No vacations, no savings, no nothing. A family of four, each of the two people working needs to make at least $14 an hour. And this is an idea that I think we need to continue to look at, which is that if we're using public subsidies, we're taxing people in order to create subsidies and basically to provide free money for private companies to profit from. It seems to me that we could at least require that the people who are subsidizing those jobs and potentially receiving, and then have the people receiving those jobs be able to make ends meet rather than having the state or local government subsidizing low-wage jobs that keep people in poverty. So I think that's something that we should look at in the future. I'm not sure that this concept of paying at least a living wage whenever we're using public subsidies to create projects is necessarily the best place to put this. But in the future, I think we should be doing this. And I just want to say to Representative Nelson that I'm glad that he is taking the opportunity to move this bill forward because, the state of Minnesota and a lot of local governments put lots and lots of tax dollars into the projects all over the place, and they don't, I think from an economic standpoint, I don't think they provide any net benefit economically to the state, but they could potentially have the benefit of increasing the rates of pay for low-wage workers, which would provide a real benefit economically to the state. So this is a good first step. I think there's a lot more work we can do in tying living wage requirements to public subsidies, and so I hope there are people who are interested in working on that.
So no amendment has been offered. We are on the bill still. Representative O'Driscoll, I do have you on the list.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on Representative Winkler's amendment. I think you were wise to withdraw it since the statute it's tied to doesn't exist right now. And secondly, the thought occurred to me when you were citing some of the demographic numbers and some of the wage rates and things. What would happen if the public subsidy was less than the cost to the business to meet your cost of living provisions? In other words, it would cost the developer more than what they're receiving from the public subsidy.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, then maybe they wouldn't do the project. But the point is the taxpayers of Minnesota are giving out money for free to these developers who are trying to put together hotel projects, restaurant projects, all sorts of things. In the case of Rochester, building a whole new city, And if the taxpayers are putting money into it, they might want to get some benefit from it. I don't think the subsidies on their own provide any net economic benefit, since you're taking money out of one group of people's pocket and putting it into another person's pocket, with the government deciding what are the desired projects. It would be far better that if there would be some other public good that came from those subsidies, which would include higher wages for low-wage workers. And so there would at least there be that public benefit involved. And so if the projects can't provide that and they're still getting a public subsidy, it seems to me they're not a very good project.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Well, Representative Winkler, just specifically to my question, I think your answer was they probably wouldn't do the project, and so that might have longer-range consequences where there wouldn't be that economic development in the community or the other jobs that were associated with that. So I guess my final comment on this, and I don't need to debate you on this matter, but it seems like there's a lot of moving parts that when sometimes the old adage, when you push one thing on one side, three things pop out the other side, and this may well be that. And so, again, I commend you for withdrawing the amendment because there's a few unintended consequences with it from my perspective.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, they're actually quite intended. I don't think we should be subsidizing projects that don't pay workers a decent wage. There's no public benefit in doing so.
I don't have any questions on the list. I do want to see if there's anybody in the audience who would like to speak. Representative O'Driscoll, did you?
Well, we can go to the audience, but Mr. Johnson's still here from the League of Minnesota Cities, and I guess I would ask him if they've looked at this or if they see that there's going to be a unintended fiscal consequence or how that might delay development in the community, or if he can weigh in on that sense. The cities of Minneapolis and Duluth and St. Paul and Rochester are all members of the League of Minnesota Cities.
Are you talking about the bill, or are you talking about the non-offered with amendments?
We're on the bill at this point.
Okay, sure. Okay. Looks like Mr. Hines has come down. If you could please identify yourself for the tape.
Well, Mr. Chair, I wanted to hear from Mr. Johnson.
He's running for the door.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr.
Hines.
Chair,
has been designated as the person to respond to this question.
Patrick Hines, League of Minnesota Cities. I apologize for disappointing Representative O'Driscoll. The league has looked at this, and we do not have an official position on it. As you noted, it doesn't affect every county in the state. It affects some, and all I can say is we don't have a position. We have looked at it and are still trying to determine what the impact might be on projects in those cities.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Well, that was probably the best non-answer I've heard all afternoon and all the bills that we've had. Thank you. I really don't have any other questions. I was wondering if you had a position on, because you were asked to come before the committee on other things. What is the effective date, Representative Nelson, on this legislation?
Representative or Chair Nelson?
Currently, there's not one on it, but I believe and Mr. Shepard, remind me, if there's not an effective date, when does it take effect?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, if this bill were adopted as a single section, it would be effective August 1st. There's no appropriation, so the default would be August 1st of 2013.
Mr. Chair? Oh, thank you. I guess the other part of this would be, as we've got, as was discussed earlier, the Mayo project that could be affected by this. And we also have one that the legislature moved through last year, which is the Viking Stadium. And I'm wondering if the Viking Stadium would be subject to this as of August 1st, because there's, at least as it stands right now, the idea of letting some bids and doing some different things on here, or if that would be exempted because of the August 1st date.
Chair Nelson.
And Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, if you look at the handout I had, that was part of the packet in my earlier testimony, the Minnesota Vikings have already signed a project or a labor peace agreement for the new stadium.
Representative O'Driscoll? Okay. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get a roll call.
Okay, a roll call has been requested. Is there anyone from the audience who would like to speak on this bill? For or against? Okay, seeing nobody, are there further questions? Okay. Yeah. Okay, a roll call has been requested, so... I'm sorry. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, Chair Nelson.
you know, we hear so much about the labor peace agreements, but what really is it? I mean, what can it look like? What does it do?
Chair Nelson.
Representative Tice and Mr. Chair, as it was said before, what it does is it's like a project labor agreement. A project labor agreement on a construction of a project, the labor gives up rights,
yeah.
And management says, okay, by doing this, we'll agree that we'll use union labor on the project. The labor peace agreement is similar context. The union says, we will give up our right to strike, to disrupt your project, to cause you grief. In return, you'll allow us to talk to the workers that you're going to hire to work in this project when it's done. And so they're giving up their right to go out and make a spectacle, to go on the floor. And we had some of this in the city of Minneapolis, which prompted the city of Minneapolis to create the labor peace ordinance, where there was a hotel project that went up, and the union was out there banging drums and banging on pots and pans and marching around the building. And the city of Minneapolis decided that was better in our favor to not have that go on and disrupt our city. And so they created the labor peace ordinance. And so the labor is giving up, the union is giving up their right to do what is legally their right to do by getting and being so they're and then being allowed to talk to the workers as they're hired and try and sell them on the fact that a union would be good for them. And that's all this is doing.
Representative Tice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Chair Nelson, I think what I meant was, and I didn't state that properly, is other guidelines to it. Do they have to follow guidelines to it when they finally do talk to the hospitality workers?
Chair Nelson?
I'll let Mr. Cummins answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tice, the guidelines are provided in federal labor law. What the state is would be mandating in this bill is just that the union must give up its right to disrupt the work, no work stoppages, and the parties would have binding arbitration to resolve disputes. What the union could and couldn't do beyond that in terms of what's legal and illegal is governed by federal labor law. And there's a bunch of case law, there's regulations, there's the National Labor Relations Act, as well as is the statute that governs that area.
Representative Tice?
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I still don't know where this need came from. I haven't heard a demonstrated need for this. It seems we haven't had any riots in state and local government. There haven't been any strikes that I'm aware of that have contributed to a need for this. Where's the fire?
Chair Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I did it again. Representative Drazkowski, it was brought to me and it was brought forward, and I'm bringing the bill forward. I was asked to carry the bill, as was noted on the floor today by the Speaker, and we had our hearing in the Labor Department or the Labor Committee, and it was moved to Rules, and then the Rules Committee waived the deadline and allowing us to proceed forward, and that's what we're doing. We're going to bring it forward to the committees that need to hear it to move this bill forward.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So sounds like, Representative Nelson, it didn't come from your constituents. It came from our leadership, or, you know, the Speaker of the House brought this forward, and I think he gave it to the right guy. Tip of the spear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski, I can't say with a straight face this is not a labor bill, but.
Okay, I have no additional questions on the list. Roll call's been requested.
Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion that House File 1765, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to Commerce.
Chair Nelson renews his motion. Any further discussion? Clerk will take the roll.
Nelson?
Aye.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Pepin?
No. I actually have a question about that motion, about the referral. Is Commerce is where you want to go, not Rules?
Yeah, it's my understanding is it's already been in Rules.
Yes.
Yes, and yeah.
And then they waived, Mr. Chair, they waived all further, happy to go back to Rules.
Okay. Clerk will continue with the roll. We can still talk about it afterwards.
Dorholt?
Yes.
Truskowski?
No.
Falk? Hansen?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Ween?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pew?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Tice?
No.
Winkler?
Yes.
There being 7 ayes and 6 nays, the motion is agreed to. So the motion, the path of the committee is clear. Or, do you, Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I.
The procedural question been answered?
Well, it has, it sort of. I still don't, I fail to understand what the point of the committee deadlines was, because there seems to be no restraint and the constant new introduction of bills that are getting heard on April 17th. The committee deadline is extended this year far past winter, which is extended far past its welcome.
Well, that's duly noted. There's not any additional business before the committee.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Chair Nelson.
And I'll just stay here and we'll finish up. I'd like to thank the members of the committee for the hard work that we've done on this committee and some of the extra work that's been put at us, as Representative Pepin noted too. I also want to thank the staff, Ms. Dyson, Mr. Shepard, our pages, Emily and Will. I'm not going to try to pronounce their last names. Members, we may have another meeting next week to take up a bill or to listen to hear a bill that Representative Falk has. And then we may have some meetings this summer. We'll look into that. So otherwise, I thank members for all their hard work on this committee and our staff, Mr. Gelbin, Mr. Marble.
Your vice chair.
And our vice chair, Mr. Freiberg, for giving him all the hard bills we have to chair. And our CLA, Mr. Gaphart.
Representative Pepin, as the minority lead, would you also like to make some closing comments here?
Thank you. I would just like to, as well, thank the hardworking staff. It's been a long session. I really want to thank the staff for all they've done. We couldn't get anything done, regardless of Republicans are in control, the Democrats were in control, without the hard work of the staff. So sincere thank you to all the staff. And having said that, I hope to not see you in committee until next year.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody, as well. So the meeting is adjourned.